Good morning. This is the Customer Service Operations and Security Committee. We're going to get started. We are without a quorum with Marilyn, but we can start the material discussion, and any actions we will defer until someone from Marilyn shows up. And with that, we will start with the safety contact. And yes, and that for today. Chief, are you going to do it? Someone is going to wing it? Okay.
In event there's an emergency, okay, there's a patient back out here. We'll sit down to the right and we'll sit. One of the things that we should be mindful of is as the COVID is changing, so I have some things that we should be following, we should write a letter, so we should be as drivers. School is back now as walking becomes earlier. We still have our children out on the roads, which should be mindful that kids are running in between cars. So as we're driving through our streets, we should be mindful of our neighborhood.
Thank you for drafting you. Mr. Lever, thank you. We want to get started with the agenda today, and we have three items here. The first item is an action item, and that item is going to provide us information on the inauguration process. In that package, we will be approving special service and extended hours along with the special fares and the fair products for the event. The committee will also be asked to grant recognition of volunteers from external law enforcement agencies as agents of WMATA during that time to allow them to assist with the security that is needed throughout the transit service system during the inauguration events. And we are going to ask to take this action so that the plans can move forward, so that we'll be prepared, and the fair media information will be available in advance of the inauguration. The other two items are information items, and they will regard the Chief Pavlik work that he and his Green have been doing with our youth in D.C., and the other item is the Safe Track update. So we'll begin now with the inauguration. Ms. Farsak.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning to the board members. As of this morning, we have 25 days, 14 hours, and now about 55 minutes until the election of the next U.S. president, but who is counting? Metro is unique among transit agencies in our service to the seat of our national government. We at Metro are very honored to provide transportation for visitors and residents who will participate in the inauguration events. This will be a national security special event that marks the safe and peaceful transition of power in our great democracy. Just a quick brief on the last inauguration for those who may not have been with Metro at that time. We had an anomaly in that it fell on a federal holiday. It was President Obama's second term, so we had fewer attendees than the more than 1.8 million who were estimated to have participated in his first inauguration. In all, we had ridership of about 782,000 on Metro Rail. While we created a special pass for the last inauguration to encourage early purchases and reduce lines at stations, the price point did not, in effect, incentivize as many early sales as we hoped. In this instance, we began planning for the 2017 inauguration nearly a year in advance. As you can see on this slide, we joined more than two dozen agencies led by the United States Secret Service and the United States Army in planning the transportation support for the event. Internally, every single department within Metro has been engaged in countdown meetings to plan all of logistical support for the week of the inauguration. Long lead procurements, system upgrades, construction and track maintenance schedules, congestion mitigation, crowd management, passenger information, and of course safety considerations are all planned months in advance. For this inauguration, staff proposed to again open the rail system an hour early, which recognizes the travelers who arrive early to get to the key locations downtown, and it complements the Secret Service's establishment of safe zones and locations where guests must pass through magnetometers. Peak rail service throughout the day and a regular Friday schedule for bus is necessary to support the projected estimate, and this year's estimate is nearly 1 million people for the 2017 inauguration day. Metro buses are expected to begin some detours on Thursday, January 19th, and continue on an extensive detour set of routes throughout the day on Friday, the 20th, due to security-related roadway closures and restrictions around the events. Temporary bus terminals, where bus routes will end on Friday, will be located around the security perimeter to expedite easy walk-in to the National Mall. It's worth noting here that those security perimeters and safe zones are generally known, but they're not finally established until we get closer to the event and the Presidential Inaugural Committee is appointed. Free bus to rail to bus transfers will be used to facilitate riders travel through and past the security zones. The turnbacks will affect about 60 bus routes, and locations and bus service managers will be assigned to assist and direct operators and customers. Metrobus also expects that the National Park Service police will request our Metrobuses provide blockades again to assist in securing the mall area. For past events, Metrobus has supplied about 60 buses, and they are stationary during the event, but each requires an operator in case the bus should need to be moved. With respect to the commemorative Smart Trip card, we're seeking the board's permission on a number of issues today. So in order to reduce queuing at vending machines and crowding in rail stations, we do recommend offering for sale online in advance a special commemorative Smart Trip card, which costs $10 and is good for inauguration day for unlimited travel on bus and rail. And we think this is a good price point and will incentivize a lot of early purchasing. We'll avoid people waiting online at stations. Additionally, we're seeking the board's approval to waive the $2 new card fee for Smart Trip cards purchased on inauguration day preloaded with a one-day rail pass. And saving that $2 enables us to give visitors a reason to leave the vending machine queues and take advantage of in-person sales at end-of-the-line stations. And we do have large groups that assemble at end-of-the-line stations and want to travel together downtown. Not all are able to purchase in advance. So that's an important feature, both in terms of customer convenience and in terms of crowd management. And now I'm going to turn it over to Chief Pavlik, who will speak to a couple of the security matters that are before the board.
Good morning, Ms. Hodges and members of the board. As Lynn stated, this is a national special security event, which is dictated by the Director of the Department of Homeland Security, which means a whole bunch of things have to happen. It lays out duties and responsibilities, and it also dictates that the United States Secret Service will be the law enforcement agency in charge of this event. Just as in previous inaugurations, we have to reach out to other transit properties to ask for their support. Due to the strain that the National Capital Region Law Enforcement Agency is under during a large-scale event like this. So far, we've had commitments from SEPTA from Philadelphia, MBTA out of Boston, MART out of Atlanta, RTD out of Denver, BART from San Francisco, and New Jersey Transit. So as these officers come in on January 17th, they'll have a welcoming event for us. Then the 18th, they'll be deputized and sworn in. They'll do a day of training, and then the January 20th is the day we go live with the event itself. In addition to those agencies, we have a number of agencies coming in with additional canine support through TSA and the VIPER program. One thing that has come up previously is, you know, we always want to protect our riders and secure, you know, crowd control details, secure facilities, you know, hand sales of our Smart Trip cards that we're doing again this year. So each time we ask for federal grant funds to help support us. We did apply for a federal grant this year, and we were awarded $250,000. When you look at previous inauguration, you go back to 2013, we spent about $700,000 just on security costs alone. And as an organization, we spent over $2 million just to cover the one-day event. So we will seek opportunities either through FEMA or DHS or other grant opportunities to help reimburse us for some of those costs.
Thank you, Chief. And so ultimately, today where that leaves us is that we're seeking board approval for a special one-day inaugural pass, waiving the Smart Trip card fee for hand sales on the day of the inauguration only, opening the rail system an hour early and charging peak fares from 4 a.m. to 9 p.m., during which time we'll be running peak rail service, charging regular parking rates at all lots, waiving the higher typical non-rider parking rate for that one day, and, of course, recognizing the sworn transit police officers from other agencies who will be supporting our own transit police department. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Second.
Thank you. With regard to the hours of service, what's the rationale behind opening an hour early?
So in our experience, Mr. Burns, Joe, the queuing starts overnight for access into the stations to get downtown. And previously, when we didn't do that, we had traffic backups that created secondary and tertiary effects on roads approaching stations, including interstates. We found that opening early gave us a relief valve and ability to accommodate more people who queue up in order to get through the magnetometers downtown.
Okay. What about the change from $15 for the hand sale card to $14.50? Why would we want to introduce change?
So today the rail pass is $14.50, and the difference is the $2 fee for the Smart Trip card itself.
You lowered the why was it $15 for a Smart Trip card in 2013? Why did the price come down?
So the price of the pass itself changed, and it's reflected here.
Okay. Do we have the discretion to change it to $15 today? I don't understand why we would want
If you made it more expensive than it is at the machine, at the vending machine, people would wait in line at the vending machine to purchase it at the lower price.
I understand, but I also understand what Mr. Dornstrow is saying, which is, you know, hand selling at $14.50 is just going to be a disaster. I mean, trying to deal with the 50 cents of change versus just the 15. I think that's part of it, right?
And also for the kiosk transactions as well.
The change on the kiosks.
To be clear, our plan for the hand sales is not to take cash at the hand sale point. So in other words, we have some handheld devices that will swipe credit cards, and so we'll be able to take people's bank cards or credit cards in the hand sale line. People wanting to use cash will still be able to do that at the machines.
Okay, well, that's an important clarification. And then Chief, is part of the training of the out-of-jurisdiction law enforcement officers going to include the evacuation plan?
It does. So we'll have several tabletop exercises as a region prior to the event, and then the one day of training we do, we'll go over emergency evacuation routes, rail familiarization training as far as the ETS boxes and other emergency equipment in and around Metro Rail stations. Yeah, so good morning again. So one thing we've been working on over the last year or so is how do we improve our youth behavior throughout the Metrorail system. Some is a perception issue that some of our riders bring to our attention, and some of it obviously is from our own observations. But one of our goals is to always promote safety among our young riders and continue to educate them. Where we reward positive behavior that we observe, where we look for ways to get them involved in improving our rail system and how they interact with our riders on a daily basis. Some other things we've been doing is with the DC1 card usage is improving the education. There's some education and DC1 flyers we created to help educate our young riders on how to use the DC1 card and what does that look like, and educate some of the parents as well. And then other things we're doing with the Metropolitan Police. You know, every day we have a 1 o'clock conference call with DC Public Schools and DC Police Department just to talk about our young riders and how we can continue to work in partnership with each other. And another initiative we're working on is we've just recently formed a partnership with a program called Strategies for Youth. It's a program that we've copied from MBTA out of Boston because they're kind of like us, where they're traveling with their youth every day, and they're their school system as well, or their transportation system as well.
In the spring of 2016, Metro held a youth empowerment summit. In partnership with MTPD and about 20 community organizations that provide services to the youth riders in the Washington metropolitan area and surrounding communities, Metro hosted a youth empowerment summit here at JGB. We had roughly 80 students, students representing all the jurisdictions in which Metro provides service. The focus of the event was to provide basically a dialogue or a platform to do a fact-finding, gather information from the students to find out what were the concerns, what were some of the challenges, as well as ways in which Metro can provide better service, meet the needs of the students that utilize our system. Our Metro staff, Metro Transit Police, as well as many community partners, and we even had local celebrities come in and talk to the students to really engage them in a meaningful dialogue. As a result of that dialogue, there were roughly 13 recommendations that came from that. Perhaps one of the most moving components of that Youth Empowerment Summit was that we had Dr. Richardson from the University of Maryland, Prince George's Hospital, and a Mr. Che Bulk from the Invisible Wounds Project talk about the impact of violence, specifically on in urban communities, youth, and both the short-term and long-term consequences. There were many important strategies that came from that, and a number of recommendations that Metro is moving forward with. And I would say that at least half of the 13 recommendations that came from this program, including improving the communications and instruction related to how students utilize the DC1 card, was probably one of the key components. There is still a lot of ambiguity related to how students should really be using this pass. And with some of the improvements that have been made on the part of DC Transit, I would say Department of Transportation in the district, the school system, and Metro, many of the students over the summer weren't aware of what happened. So the students, in fact, asked us to improve the level of communication. And to that end, we've developed a new student ride guide that should be going out and doing a number of outreach initiatives. The chief can speak to some of the other things that came from that, but I will say we also held the first Metro Student Youth Advisory Council on September 29th, where again we had about 60 students from around the region that came out. They're going to be meeting on a monthly basis to talk about issues and to keep Metro informed about what's going on with the DC1 cards, behavior issues, challenges going on in communities. So there were, in fact, some really meaningful discussions and advice and communications that came out of that meeting.
Yeah, so as Ms. Green said, the summit recommendations, we asked them, how can we better, as a police department or as an organization, how can we better interact with the youth that use our system? And, some of those recommendations were very simple, from public service announcements to a resource card to better educate them on the do's and don'ts of the system. And we've really expanded that through the Respect Your Ride campaign. The Respect Your Ride campaign is something we kicked off about 2 years ago, where we've gone now over 30 schools this year alone, touched about 10,000 students, and really trying to get into their schools and work with them and show them, You know, some of the horseplay that you may see on a playground or a street corner isn't inherently dangerous, but when committed in a metro system, it can be. So we teach them not just security issues, but also safety concerns, danger of the third rail, falling from the platform, the granite edge, what happens when a train's approaching. So it's more than just security, but it's safety and security combined. And it's really the partnerships here internally to Metro with our station managers, our train operators, our bus operators, relentless outreach that Treasury's been doing with the transit police, you know, over 100 outreach events. Again, as Joe talked about, is educating them on the DC-1 card and really just making them aware of their surroundings and what is acceptable behavior when using Metro system. As we look at our next steps, that youth interaction training, that again is something we're doing new. It's called Strategies for Youth. We're piling that for us really from the MBTA, who's had great success with it. And really, that's really educating law enforcement and frontline employees to educate and how to speak with young riders on their level, working more with them on their level, and then in partnership with that is showing them what our expectations are as far as appropriate behavior. The continued partner with the groups is obviously the community groups is very important. We believe the Student Riders Advisory Council is going to be a big avenue to help move that ball forward. And then just the partnership that we have to continue with DCPS and MPD. You know, the daily conference call says a lot. And during that daily conference call, they may talk about an incident that occurred at a local school or, you know, social media chat that says, hey, we're all going to meet at the metro station after school today. So it's really that interaction, that sharing of intelligence real time with Metropolitan Police and continuing the partnership with DCPS that's making this program successful.
Just add, I just would like to publicly thank staff for their work. I think in this day and age, in some communities, the relationship between the police and the communities is in some areas poor. And to see this type of outreach, to get into the local schools and start, you know, speaking to these kids at a very young age, I think is a great thing that your police department's doing. And I just congratulate you and thank you for your work.
Wearing their personal protective equipment, safety vests, safety glasses, and as well improvement in housekeeping. And particularly in our work zones, this is very important as it's a leading indicator of accidents and accident prevention. In the graph in the bottom right, you can see our safety performance. This is our employee injury rate. We had a spike in July and August. These are as our surges got hotter and more intense. We've been working very hard to bring that down. And as you can see, the trend is very positive, bringing it down in August. And in September, we had no injuries across surges 8 and 9. Work accomplished to date, we have done 8 of our safety surges. Surge 9 is about 60% complete as we speak. 6 of these surges have completed with more than 100% of the planned work complete. For the work that was not completed, we have it tracked, and we will track it to completion. The only major element that was not completed as planned during a surge was a grout pad near National Airport. That work has since been completed in a separate weekend single tracking event in September. So overall, the program is on track to deliver that 3 years' worth of work in 1 year. So when we talk about it, what is this work that we're delivering? Within the safety surges, it is the basic work to keep the trains on the track. We are addressing the root causes of derailments and speed restrictions by focusing on critical maintenance activities that achieve a state of good repair. We're also working off our FTA corrective action plans and focusing our resources on those activities that take the most mobilization time or require the most time to complete. So these are switch replacements, work in the interlockings where we need power down on both tracks, the replacement of cross ties and grout pads. A key component I would like to focus on is the cross tie. This is the system that holds the rails together. As I said, it's fundamental to safe operation of our tracks. It is also the item that gets the greatest benefit from the surge. In a regular non-revenue night between midnight and 5 a.m., we can install on average 5, maybe 10 cross ties. In 24 hours within one of the safety surges, we can install over 200. And on surge 9, our super gang, our new approach that we implemented on this long surge, we think may have doubled that, achieving almost 400 cross ties in a 24-hour period. So these safety surges are really critical to getting a huge volume of cross ties done. Looking at the chart in the upper right, what we have here is the cross ties planned per month and what we've actually been able to achieve. What I'd like to draw your attention to are the four lines working their way across the graph. The top line is our high-level plan. This was the track quality improvement plan. As you can see, it's a very aggressive plan. The orange line below it is what we have actually achieved. So we are just under our plan, and much of the difference relates to the difference in our estimated high-level plan versus what we actually needed to replace when we went out and did the final detail inspection prior to the surge. On average, it's been plus or minus 20% from our initial estimate to what was actually needed to be replaced in a given area. What's most important, though, is to recognize the difference between both the blue and orange line and the green line. The green line is where we would be in a normal year without these safety surges. So you can see we have significantly exceeded where we would normally be by October, and we are on track to triple what we would do in a normal year. So within the safety surges, we plan first for that basic track work, but we also seek to maximize all of the other work that can be done safely and efficiently. So this is what we call our secondary scope or beneficial use of the surge. And what we focus on is those other activities that can move in where crews can work safely either behind or ahead of the track work crews. We've made significant advancements in inspecting our emergency trip stations, and we've inspected 280 through surge 8. Replacing high voltage cables, having replaced 534 through surge 8, refurbishing signals, and inspecting and repairing our intrusion detection warning system, having done 562 boxes to date. All of this work is work that is in other capital projects and other budget lines that is accelerated and delivered within the surge. Our safe track is about more than just the 15 safety surges. We also have a lot of work going on, what we call non-surge. And really the difference between a surge and a non-surge is whether or not we are affecting the weekday peak period. So non-surge work takes place either on the weekends in single tracking, what we call early outs, when we start single tracking at either 10 p.m. or 8 p.m., and in some cases midday between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., between the rush periods. Now this work is equally important to safe and reliable service. What we're working on here is improving the drainage, as standing water and mud can undermine the components of our track and structure system, removing mud and debris, and torquing the bolts to maintain structural integrity of the tracks. In addition, these crews are also addressing speed restrictions, so as items are uncovered by our track inspections, they go to those areas where a problem has been identified and resolve it as quickly as possible. Within this work, what we have found since we've started was the need to dedicate a crew to the red line between Medical Center and Farragut North. We have one crew of 16 people now that works just on that line working to repair leaks, rehabilitate the drains, clear mud and debris, and ensure that track bed is cleared. And what this will do is this will help prepare us to prevent the risk or reduce the risk of insulator fires and other incidents that could cause delays in that section. Work completed to date. In order to put the Safe Track plan in context, this chart shows the plan and the progress to date as a percent of the normal year's worth of maintenance work. A normal year would be about 15,000 cross ties, 36,000 fasteners, 12,000 insulators, or 5,500 leaks. So if you look at the 100% line, that's where we would be. The blue bars show what the plan for Safe Track is, and as you can see, the plan for cross ties is over 300% of the normal plan. So when we talk about doing 3 years worth of work in one, we're primarily focused on these cross ties. However, the red and yellow bars show what we have done to date. Red is what we've done in the surge areas. Yellow-orange is what we have done in the non-surge areas. Again, what we can see from this chart is that the cross tie work is completely done on our safety surges. However, in the non-surge areas, we're making significant progress on fastener renewal and replacing our insulators. With the insulators, we've already done more in the last 4.5 months than we did last year. Now, these first two components are about keeping trains, as I said, on the track, ensuring the rails are the right distance apart and remain that way even under the dynamic loading of a passing train. Without the work of replacing cross ties and fasteners, we would see more speed restrictions and the eventual deterioration of our system. The other items are related to the maintenance of our track and structures and reducing other causes of delays, whether that's arcing insulators or other leaks and debris on the tracks. So that covers the work that we've achieved in the last 4.5 months. The other few items I want to touch on were on quality improvement. We have multiple levels of quality control and quality assurance processes that we've implemented on SafeTrack and that will spread to other areas of the organization. For quality control, the groups that are doing the maintenance are primarily responsible to QC their own work. They do this after the work is done. A separate entity, someone who did not actually install it, comes out to inspect it to verify it was within, that it was in compliance with our standards. A separate team, QUICO, our quality and internal compliance organization, comes out after the work has been completed and does their QA sampling, where they look at the work, sample 20% of it, and ensure that it was, in fact, done in accordance with our standards. We are also actively learning and improving with each surge and each week, with focused attention and early success with safer work practices, more efficient use of our track time through better work planning, and improving a material laydown and cleanup to mitigate risk of damage to other track components. Another key topic to recognize is the impact on our ridership. I think, again, here we have a positive news story where we've managed to achieve the diversion rates we needed for the first 5 surges. I think there is a risk that people begin to understand this work and they start being complacent and not recognizing that we really do need the diversion rates we publish. We need people to do different things because buses cannot replace a rail car fully. What you see in this chart is the diversion rate that we needed and what we were able to actually achieve. The key takeaway is that what we've seen is achieving that diversion rate, but the residual losses abating after about 1 to 2 months, meaning people are returning to the system after the surge 1 to 2 months later. System-wide, our rail ridership is down about 10 to 15% since SafeTrack began. Back in July, we did an online we surveyed our Amplify online community. We will be going back to them again this month. What we have found is that 69% of this community was impacted by at least one surge, and 65% did abandon Metro Rail for those surges but returned for at least some of their other trips. Another key takeaway here was that of the community surveyed, two-thirds of the directly affected individuals reported that their employers were actually doing something to help mitigate these commuting challenges. The jurisdictional support here has been vital, with additional bus service provided, additional support provided throughout all of the safety surges. Looking ahead, Surge 10 begins on October 29th. It will be a challenge and an impact to the entire Red Line. It is a 25-day shutdown, and the service impacts will be felt, as I said, across the entire red line. The plan for this surge includes replacement of a double crossover, significant tie renewal, and structural repairs to the Rhode Island Avenue station. Customer outreach for Surge 10 will begin by October 15th, 2 weeks before the surge, and will also coincide with our next Amplify survey. And what you can see there in our bottom right is our super gang, as it's just wrapping up here on Surge 9 and is ready to move over to Surge 10. That is all I have. Are there any questions?
Any questions, Mr. Lovey?
I have a question on your third slide when you talk about proving compliance with safety requirements. Mm-hmm. Up in the corner, work zone set up 99%, safety vest 94%. Does this mean this is in a surge area? Is that correct?
Correct.
And that means that you have 6% of the people that aren't wearing safety vests or don't have their safety glasses. That seems very, very disturbing to me that people would be working in a surge zone without protective equipment. And these are the ones that are actually been monitored. Is that correct?
Yes, it is a concern. I think safety is a cultural issue that we need to tackle every single day to remind people the importance of all of their gear.
Why would anybody be allowed to work in a surge area that's not properly protected? I'm really disturbed about this. In the industry, people that don't have their hard hats, their vests, their safety shoes, their hearing protection, their safety masks, those people aren't allowed to work. Why would you have 94%? That's very low.
Well, we don't allow them to work. If anyone is found without their proper PPE, they're immediately stopped and either told to put it on if they have it with them and if for some reason have taken it off, or are escorted off the site until they get it. So what you're seeing is that we have inspectors out there. When they find problems, they're reporting them, and we are talking about them and seeing an improvement in it. I think we also have some challenges with how we define our work zone and where exactly does it begin. Right? If you've been through our stations, we have our kiosk and our safety briefer set up, and you are still in a public area as you approach the work zone. So it's something that we've improved on, and we will continue to work on until that says 100%. Because I agree with you that it is not acceptable to allow people to work without their PPE.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Lobby's point was some of the piece, and I wonder if this shouldn't be a reversal of how we are reporting it. Because I think that it implies that there's a percentage of success, and rather than emphasizing the I want to say negligence, but the absence of acknowledging the safety piece, maybe a better way to turn it around so we see it a little bit more. There were 5 last week or month, and now there are only 4 versus. It's a percentage, I think, it reflected, but it's very graphic in the other way. Yeah.
Sure.
Ms. Austin.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the report. As I've got a couple of things that come to mind for me. One, the first is that, I think that this report actually is in the wrong committee. Most of the report is in the wrong committee, and that it really should be in the capital committee. You're really talking about, you know, these are capital projects. They're going to flow into the process that we're going through, as I'm on that committee as well. A lot of what the things that are going on that you're showing in here and the program management that's going with those things on an ongoing basis, it is on the capital side. This is the customer service, operations, and security committee. And as far as I could see, there were 2 slides, the ridership impact and the Amplify slide. They really talked to customer service, really spoke to the customer service, and really spoke to and they also really don't really talk necessarily to the operation, which, of course, and I've shared this with you guys, that I really would want to hear. I mean, I really want to hear how this process has thus far made our system more reliable in those places in the surges where we have gone through the surges. Have we seen an uptick in reliability in those areas? I mean, we should see it. We should, or I hope that we see it. And I would want to see that reported. I mean, as far as so that we can share with the public that this investment that's being made, that this bringing forward of all this work, that there's some tangible value that's coming out of it that we can see in the reliability of the system, which will then, of course, translate hopefully into a greater satisfaction. And then additionally, finally, more riders. And so I feel like that's what we really have to be talking about in here. That is, you know, that's really our charge. And I definitely would like to hear much more about that. I still say, Mr. Leader, I feel, Mr. Leader, that, you know, obviously Mr. Off is here. We have this situation where we've got folks, again, I'm glad to see them because they have the operations and that's what they should do. But we still have that competition between people who are charged with operating the system versus those who are charged with the safety and are charged with, you know, kind of the capital project side of it and those competing interests. And they really, I think that those two really are two different interests and that they should be coming under, in essence, the different sides. And so those are important to me, I think, and that's just my comment.
Just to get back to your comment about reliability, it is one of the areas that we are looking at, how to develop a KPI, because when you look at your line segments, you know, you have more than one asset. So how do you define reliability for that line segment? So it is something that staff is looking at, and we hope, you know, in the next coming months that we will have a KPI that we could look at, whether it's the, you know, the A line, you know, is running at such and such reliability, and then be able to drill down in between interlockings what that reliability is, and then drill down even further what that asset, the different asset classes, and that's what we're looking to go to, but we're not there yet. We're not there yet. But I hear you.
And it's the KPIs that we get those measurements from. And I think you're right. This may be lacking some of that information on specifics others, but I think collectively some of this information feeds into other KPIs because of the reliability piece and also on the safety piece.
Now, I agree that it does, but what I'm suggesting is that we see that. I agree that it does, but we should be able to draw straight lines from this. As we talked about, like you're saying, that the cross ties, we should have fewer instances that show up that say, you know, we've got to divert trains because of, you know, of wide gauge, for example. Or fasteners. I mean, we've seen this. We're getting alerts about fastener issues and fastener problems. So, again, if we're replacing fasteners, I would hope then that we would see a reduction of those types of incidents because of this process that we're going through.
Any other questions? Any other comments? Okay. Mr. Dornshaw, I didn't see you.
Do we take a look at the work completed to date slide? There aren't page numbers here, or slide numbers, but there's a graph. That one, back. Is this labeled properly? Because the blue column is that the SafeTrack plan, or is that the typical year? Because those would be two different things, right?
Yes, I'm sorry, I see the confusion. The height of the blue bar is the SafeTrack plan. The typical year label was at that 100% line. So you could see where we would have been in a normal year if it wasn't for SafeTrack.
Okay. okay, so I look at the red and the yellow, and that tells us where we are to date. And we're tracking fairly well against the typical year. And even though you've done a lot of cross ties relative to the plan, we still have a long way to go.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Would we have this information by December for what is found to be kind of safe track two. I mean, the management team has essentially asked for more maintenance time than you currently have. Right now you have 39 hours. The GM's proposal is 41 hours, so that's an increase in maintenance time. That's a very significant policy decision. We're going to public hearing on that, but we don't have any of the information regarding what that will actually buy us. So it seems reasonable to me. You have the Safe Track plan, you know, from June to June, from 16 to 17. What is the plan for July forward? If we're doing 3 years of work in 1 year, are we intending to do 4 years of work in 1 year, starting July 1 of next year? I mean, wouldn't it be important to know why you need to essentially reduce the operating hours of the system so dramatically on a continuous basis? Wouldn't we need to know what you're actually going to accomplish?
I think to answer your question, the plan moving forward past July, we do not see from a track perspective an aggressive track surge plan that we have right now. We feel we'll be going back into more maintenance, more weekend type work, maybe some early outs, doing some fastener replacements. We would like to begin some preventive maintenance initiatives, such as tamping, surfacing, more butte welding, and things that have not been able to be done when we had the current window of years ago of 3 o'clock in the morning or 1 o'clock in the morning. So the idea behind it is we feel once this initial track surges are over, we won't see as an aggressive track surge program moving forward on the track side. We feel we'll be going back into regular work that we've been doing under our non-service hours and our weekend general orders, or diversions, as we call them here, diversions. But track surges could be used in other areas of the capital program and things like that, because there's a lot of other asset work that falls under John Thomas's area that needs to be looked at. So I think moving forward, that's where we'll probably see some of the track surges going. From a track standpoint, we still need hours of work to begin some preventive maintenance issues that issues that we want to begin. You know, if we fall back to 3 o'clock in the morning or 1 o'clock in the morning, we'll never be able to get back into a preventive maintenance cycle. And that's really where we want to lead the agency.
Okay, so Safe Track 2 would have far fewer safety surges, but the maintenance windows are still your position is the maintenance windows are required for a different type of activity.
Absolutely. Maintenance repairs.
But that can be quantified, right?
Yes.
And shouldn't it be quantified by the time we make a decision about the operating hours?
Let me just comment because I was going to ask your question differently, and that is, if we get back to what was the normal system hours, which was 12 midnight, what would be the maintenance work and accomplishment that needs to get done during that hour versus what you would be able to do at 3? And I think that's the delta that people are trying to put in the conversation that we're having, because the surge is a catch-up piece, and the assumption is the system will have a possible norm, and then we'll move forward of trying to maintain a level of safety.
I thought at one of the last committee meetings, we laid out the initiatives. We could lay out. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wouldn't be able to lay out these are the locations we're going to be working, but we could lay out a span of how the work would progress under those hours. Yes, we could do that.
Yeah. And I guess what I was saying is maybe those. We're talking about the cross ties, the fasteners, et cetera. And I think maybe a better understanding of how much work is entailed and time needed to inspect the cross ties and check the fasteners. And if you don't do X during this given amount of time, you now start to become deficient. And I that's to me the delta that we are missing here, so that we can. I'm just trying to think of a better way to articulate it, but I think that's going to be a very important piece to answering that question.
Chair Hudgens, I asked the.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm responding to what Mr. Dornsjoe was talking about, and I think that this is part of this slide speaks to it at least a little bit, where it talks about what the normal work windows would look like for cross ties, and then the actual that you've been able to do because you've had the surges, if I understand it, but that if it were under those normal windows, this is at least some of the information I think that you're talking about that you're asking for. Like, this is what would actually be what we would be able to get accomplished. Am I right on that?
Yes, I believe so. Yes. We could get you. We could lay out. I think the idea is we could lay out some of the work that we would like to do, regardless of the location. But we could give you a general idea how we would spend that time during our non-service hours. We could do that. Okay. If that would help.
Any other? Yes.
Yeah, I think Mr. Drumshare makes a great point, and I agree with it totally. We have to quantify that because I think it suggests to people that we're even intensifying what we're already doing if you're asking for these service cuts and changes, and maybe there's a bit of a disconnect there. Okay. And for instance, you know, this slide here, you know, the green line ticks up there toward the end. So after the surge, do all these lines readjust? Are you going to push all of them up, you know, as part of your regular maintenance plan moving forward?
Sir, if I could, Andy Ong. So the intent is, in SafeTrack was to, you know, remove the backlog. Coming out of SafeTrack to return us to a point where we could maintain an annual cyclical cycle of roughly 15,000 ties a year. So what we should see generally in fiscal year 17 is a return to, you know, our normal cyclical rates for those components.
But again, I think, you know, quantifying it and putting it and making that connection, I think, is going to be important.
Yes, sir. We can definitely, we have, you know, done the calculations in terms of hours to perform what preventive maintenance tasks, you know, as Joe alluded to, surfacing, tamping, welding, torquing, and things of that nature. It's just not in a format that's, you know, suitable, you know, for a presentation, you know, in this form. But we have done those calculations.
And also to Kathy, if I could, and to Mr. Lauby's point, that second or third slide there, that struck me as well, that you wouldn't have near 100% compliance with some of those things. Safety glasses and vests, I mean, why isn't that 100%? It just, I mean, I heard your explanation, but it seems, yeah.
There's just one last thing. Yeah, there's a slide here that is titled Ridership Impacts, and there's a note on the bottom in small print number two, which says, it assumes background loss of 8 to 10% that would have occurred without SafeTrack. And that, so what do we attribute that background loss to? As you're saying, system-wide, the ridership is down 11 to 15%. Are we saying that more than half of that would have happened anyway?
I think this. We're taking time from them, and there must be other information that we need to say that ridership is changing.
Yeah, I think this also reflects the historical trend that we've seen declines in ridership, plus the reduced service shows where we are relative to last year. So when we compare year on year, we're trying to account for both those larger changes. We've seen a decline in ridership as well as the direct impacts of SafeTrack.
Mrs.
not specific.
Any other questions?
I have.
Yes, Ms.
This is a true trivia question, but I have to ask it since we're about to wrap up. On your next to last slide, the Amplify Online Community Survey, you have a line at the very bottom that there were 5% that used other ways to travel. But if they didn't bike, ride, use the train, use the bus, do we know what that is? And don't worry if you don't, but it struck me as something very curious.
So it's, if I can answer, the customer response on that is varied. Uber, Lyft, biking, walking in some instances, carpooling, vanpooling, all of those.
Those are all listed as other choices. In other words, that you show you Uber, Metrobus, Metro, you show everything else.
Oh,
don't worry about this. It just struck me as very peculiar.
Okay, I'm sorry. So, yeah, they just indicated something else, and then they didn't offer what
they
that something
specify.
Else
so
was.
So this is
yeah,
non-specific responses.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
right.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation. And as we get to the end, I want to go back, and we have to approve the minutes. May I have a motion?
So moved.
And a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. And with that, we are concluded. Thank you.
With minutes to spare, good job.
Who's next?
So this is David's Capital Program Committee, and then next door is Sarah's Administration Committee. They're going to talk about the procurement plan, and then Tom's doing the Pension Committee, which has been helping chair by the law.
Okay.
So you hang out wherever you'd like.
Which this one?
This is the capital program. We're giving an update on the capital needs inventory. Yeah, I'll let you know when the pension discussion starts.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah.
Also undecided on this one. I know the Secretary Fox has prioritized safety. Exactly. So, exactly. There we are. So, I see.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And is the number I've been calling the way to get to?
I don't know what number you've been calling.
I actually spoke to your sister and said she was going to reach out to you.
Okay. I was literally all, I was out all day. But, yep, that's perfect. Okay, thanks, sir.
By 2 weeks. So again, there's a milestone in your clients or your constituents that have concerns. We need to get those concerns in.
They're just not going to bid, Ken. They're just not going to bid.
Well, then shame on them, you know?
Yeah. They just think that the process is rigged. They think the time frame is too short.
Even if
they get this started. Hey, Tony, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
I'm just telling you.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Capital Program Planning and Real Estate Committee to order, please. I know we have a very tight schedule. I know we have a couple of our members are returning from a quick break. Let's go ahead and get things started. First, I'd like to move our first item of business is to approve the agenda. Does anyone have any suggested changes or modifications? We are in pause until Mrs. Begberg returns.
So who? Do some information stuff.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's go on ahead and turn then to going ahead and get Mr. Thomas started. First, we have two issues or information on this. First is about the capital needs inventory. The CNI provides an unconstrained prioritized list of Metro's capital needs over the next 10 years and will be coordinated with Metro's ongoing maintenance capital expenses to provide a holistic overarching picture of the authority's total capital requirements. Next, the committee will receive an update on one of Metro's significant capital projects, which is the replacement of radio infrastructure throughout the Metro system, which will also provide the infrastructure for the cellular neutral host system. Now I'll turn to Mr. Thomas, who is our acting chief engineer, to review the CNI. Mr. Thomas.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Pleasure to be here today to give you another update on where we are on our capital needs inventory. If you recall, we did an update for where we were back in July. So here's our agenda. We've broken this sort of into three pieces. We're going to sort of give you a context and overview. We'll try not to dive too much into process here and just sort of give you a snapshot of where we are. We now have some outputs from the process. We'll go through that next, and then we'll get a little bit into project management. Briefly, in the past, what we did for the current capital funding agreement to identify what we were going to do was we did a combination of call for projects and professional judgment. We're doing a much more rigorous process this time around to develop a capital needs inventory. We're doing it based upon an asset inventory of everything that we own. And then currently it's on an age-based assessment for its condition and using a scoring methodology for our prioritization. And then I'll get a little bit more into that in the next slide. And then the third column there is showing you where we plan to be in about 2 years. So where we have, so far we've identified about 75,000 assets, which seems like an awful lot, but when you actually look at the database, you'll find that it's, you know, sort of broad-brushed listing of items that doesn't get necessarily down into much of the detail. What we have primarily for each of those assets is an age-based assessment of whether or not it should be replaced. So it's fundamentally, if it's 40 years old, it's considered to be at or near past its useful life. If it's 10 years old, it's not. That's not based upon people's putting eyes on it and professional judgment. But that's where we are today in this process. You can see that we're using the prioritization, the third column there, safety, regulatory compliance, service delivery, and ridership. Impacts is the methodology we're using, the standards we're using for prioritization. And then we have the fourth thing, which is existing versus new assets. And that's obviously everything that we own today, but then there are some things that are new that we've put into the program that we believe need to be performed as well. So where we expect to be in about 2 years is have a much larger list of items. That 75,000 will grow probably by leaps and bounds, order of magnitude. But also what we will do have by then is an actual assessment, physical assessment of the condition of the thing. So just because it's 40 years old, it actually may be in really good shape and therefore not in need of any
attention at this within the next capital program, and the 10-year-old thing might be in need of that. So that's where we expect to be in about 2 years. So what we're teeing this program up to do here is, and on this slide, what we're trying to do is set ourselves up to have essentially two views of how we're going to take care of what we own. The lower area that's in the blues and the reds are what I like to call steady state. Those are the things that are always going to be there. We're always going to be doing them. The example that I always use is we're always going to be replacing a certain number of ties every year. That's a steady state kind of work that we're always going to be doing. And we'll have there's a whole host of those kinds of things that are always going to be there for us to remain in a state of good repair. And above that, in the rectangular box, are those things that are going to come out of the CNI, which are asset replacements. Eventually, those things that get the regular attention will eventually have to be replaced. So that's one area. Major rehabilitation, if it's beyond its normal sort of routine maintenance. And then newly identified needs, and then there's always mandates that come from various locations. One of the examples that I'll give you as a newly identified need is a project we did a couple years ago. Many of our older underground stations that have a single entrance have a single pair of escalators going from the mezzanine to the platform. So there's one way up, one way down. But there are many locations in the system where we built into the mezzanine the capacity to add additional vertical transportation. There's essentially a hole in the mezzanine. So a few years ago, we went up to Bethesda Station, which is with single entrance sort of configuration, and we added a set of stairs between the mezzanine and the platform. It ended up costing the neighborhood of $400,000. But it does two things. It provides another path for people to get off the platform to get up to the mezzanine or vice versa, whether for convenience or in case of an emergency. But another significant advantage to that, when our elevator and escalator people go in and do an escalator replacement, you've often seen where we have just a single escalator that is in off mode and it works for both directions. When we went in Bethesda and put those stairs in, we now have another path for people to get up and down from the platform to the mezzanine and not depending upon that single escalator when we're doing a replacement. So that's the kind of thing that we see going into the newly identified needs as part of the CNI as opposed to replacing or rehabbing the infrastructure that we have. So the next slide shows what we've done to date. We've got a lot of information on identifying the vehicles, the guideways, and the systems, and we're getting close on the other systems, facilities, and stations. And again, this is at a high level, and there's a slide coming up a little bit. We'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by high level. But that's sort of where we are today. There's been a lot of work done in the 6 months that we've been spending on this, but we've got a lot more work to do to get to a more robust list of information and have it be really meaningful for us. So when we're planning to come back in December to provide another update, and this is sort of a snapshot of what we're going to have. It'll be taking the inventory that we have today, making sure that there's a logic to what's there, there's a methodology to how we're going to present it, and it'll provide us enough information for prioritization at a broad scale. What we've done so far is we've identified in the neighborhood of $39 billion of assets. That's sort of the sum of everything that we own and assigning a replacement value to that. That's a pretty large number, but it is the thing about it is it's actually the cost of the thing. So if we're going to replace the thing, that's not the cost of replacing. That doesn't include the soft costs associated with replacing a thing. So if there's $100 million bridge rehab, that's in there, that doesn't include the other costs, the design costs, the management costs, and so forth. So this $39 billion is just the cost of our stuff that we have today.
which is a pretty significant number. On the next slide, now we're going to get into just a snapshot of the database that we have of information with the priorities ranking. And I alluded earlier to the broad brush, the way this is. And so if you look at, if you can see it, item two says track work AHR. What that means is it's track work for the A line, and the A line is from Metro Center out to Shady Grove. And the HR is heavy rail. And if you look over on the right, it says quantity of 273,000. What that means is there's 273,000 linear feet between Metro Center and the tail of Shady Grove. The reality is what that's referring to is both tracks, so 273,000 divided by two, but you see that it says 27 elements. Obviously, in 26 miles of railroad, there are a lot more than 27 elements. So that's the purpose of showing this here, is to say that we've got some good information, you know, at a broad scale, but it doesn't mine down yet to get into the details of everything that's within that 26 miles on both tracks. So just wanted to just give you a sense of what that means as an example of where we are in terms of the scale of what we're getting into. So this is just a snapshot of some of the newly identified needs or mandates that are in the CNI as of right now. PENTA, actually, we're hoping to have that implemented here in the next few months, which is the communication where it's text to voice for the OCC, so they'll be able to get information out without the variability of individual speakers. But then you can see these are, again, some other items that we've identified that are in there or that are new items. The mandates are, you know, the tunnel smoke detection, which is an FTA requirement that they've asked us to take care of. So this, we show this as a circular process because this is, you know, where we are, but this is an ongoing thing. So when we finally have a product that's a great level of detail in 2 years, and the two-year time frame is tied to an FTA requirement to have an asset inventory program in place, to their satisfaction, and we believe we'll be there in 2 years. But after that is done, this is a process that we should be going through on an annual basis to make sure that we're keeping after and paying attention to all of the assets that we have. But as you can see, where we are 6 months in is early in the process. So we just want to make sure everybody understands that when we come back in December, we're not going to have a list of everything that we own, an inspection-based assessment of everything that we own, so we can understand everything that we need to fund in terms of replacements or repairs. So one of the things that we're going to do differently going forward on the project management side, in the current CIP, when a project was established in there and it was funded, and I'll use a bus garage, one of the new bus garages, for example. When we put the bus garage for Cinder Bed, which is the replacement of Royal Street, in there, we put in $100 million in round figures over the course of several years, even though we were at the sort of the pre-development phase of that project. Well, as that project went on, you know, there were issues that we had. We had a lawsuit that delayed the project for 2 years. We've had problems with permitting being issued. So that project showed, you know, certain expectation of expenditures over in the early phases that just didn't come to fruition because we just weren't mature enough with the knowledge of that project to be able to predict that accuracy of expenditures. So as the board was getting updates on the capital program over the years, we were showing a lot of underspending. We had many projects that were in that kind of situation where they were being delayed by, you know, third party or lawsuits or so forth and so on, which sort of, you know, frustrated everybody that we were underspending. So what we're going to do for those projects going forward under the new policy and practices is when there's a new bus garage or a new thing, what we're going to do is we're going to fund the pre-development project costs first. you know, the few million dollars to get us through whatever we have to go through from a regulatory standpoint, environmental assessment, permitting, coordination with utilities, and advance the design to a higher level of completion so we can also know what the thing is going to cost as well. So we'll have a better handle on the time frame for implementation as well as the cost associated with it. So when we get through the pre-development phases, we will then, if the project is still worthy of doing, we will then fund it from that point on with a more accurate number and a more accurate spend rate. So we think that'll help us in terms of representing how we're doing on spending on these major capital projects. And this is some of the things we're going to use for an evaluation, you know, as we're going through the pre-development phase. It's a long laundry list and probably is not complete, but it gives you a sense of the rigor that we're going to go through before our project goes into the program as a $100 million project. It'll show up as a $2 million project or a $3 million project until we get through these kind of evaluations through the pre-development phase. So one of the things we wanted to chat about here briefly was on these pages, this page and this page. This is sort of an overview of the investment categories of where we are this fiscal year, the proposed for next fiscal year, and then the out years beyond that. And one of the things that we're seeing right now for FY18 as it relates to with the CNI is the FY18 capital budget is probably one way to describe it is oversubscribed. So the fact that we are in an early stage in the development of the CNI, which eventually will feed into the CIP, is not the worst thing in the world simply because there doesn't look to be much capacity in FY18 to be able to fund any new initiatives. Obviously, if something comes out of the analyses that we're doing and the prioritization that it's, you know, a critical life safety item, we will fund that and get that taken care of. But the other sort of getting us to state of good repair items that are going to come out of that process are not likely to be able to be funded in FY18 just because of the things that are in various stage of process and commitment that have got us subscribed to a pretty significant number next year. And this is just a breakdown of one of the a portion of one of the categories on the previous slide. So going forward, so we have a draft of the list today. We're going to continue to work on that and develop it and refine it. We'll come back to the board the end of the year with an update of where we are. And then we're going to dive deeper, and we actually have consultants that are getting on board now to help us do condition assessments for our facilities and systems. So we're going to spend a good portion of the next year and even into 18 refining the list of items that are on the CNI, breaking them down into more you know, manageable bites, and also doing an assessment of those items. Excuse me. And then in 18 and beyond, it becomes a sort of an annual thing that we need to be doing to make sure that we don't fall into disrepair. And that's the end of the presentation.
Mr. Thomas, thank you. Before we turn to committee discussion, do any of the members of the committee have any additional items for the agenda? If not, I'll approve the agenda as listed, and let's turn to committee discussion. Any questions for Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chair. Ms. Pepper. Mr. Thomas, something you just said, bringing in consultants now to help look at this. So up to this point, is this report strictly staff-led, or was there input from FTA or other outside parties in development of this initial report?
So there have been some consultant support, so now the consultants to which I was referring are essentially inspectors to help us with the condition assessment. The consultants that we've had so far have been helping us with the program and setting up the methodology for how we're going to analyze the assets. Is that a fair assessment?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Costa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the update. At the risk of sounding like Captain Obvious, the work that you're doing really serves as the underpinning to really make folks more confident that we know what we need to do in the coming years. And so this is terrific work. I'm glad we're doing it before FTA is requiring it. But I would submit that we actually need to do it well before FTA requires it for the initial reason about confidence building. I want to understand, because you've essentially presented two major initiatives. One is a deep dive really into the assets to understand what the needs are in a different kind of detail than in the past. That will take 2 years. But there's also an initiative related to project readiness. They're connected, but they're different. What I'd like to understand is, I know this will take 2 years to get to completion, but we'll have two capital programs proposed, one in the coming months for 18, and a year from now, 19. And you will not have completed all of this work. So I think it'd be good for everyone to understand how you think this fall and next year's proposal for 19 will be informed by this work, both the CNI work and the project readiness work. And to lead the witness, I hope on the project readiness work, that will be executed sooner than the CNI work is fully completed. That's probably not clear, but you will make it clear. Right?
So on the latter, on the project readiness, in this current fiscal year, we have a project called Bladensburg Rebuild. Maybe not exactly that, but it's intended to be the rebuild of Bladensburg Bus Garage. When you look at the line item in there, you see a little bit of money this year, and then there's some money in the out years, but it is not the full amount of money needed for that project. So we've already, with the current budget, and then obviously in next budgets, when it's those types of projects that we know that have a lot of pre-development work, we've already moved to budgeting to reflect, let's get smarter about what it is before we completely fund it, show it as a funding all the way out into the tail in the latter years.
So the capital program proposal this fall, you've already started to implement the new project planning.
Actually, we did last year because it's in FY17 for one of the projects. So okay. We will continue that practice of not oversubscribing the program with projects that we know have that a lot of that work, upfront work.
Great. That's good news. Thanks. On the CNI?
On the CNI, again, I think that FY18's budget seems to be so oversubscribed that we're not sure that there's going to be much that comes out of this process that's going to feed into that. Those things that we identify that we already don't know that are, fire life safety critical, that I get identified, we'll find a place for them. I mean, we have to. And we just learned something just the other day about some falling concrete at Northern Bus Garage. It's not funded anywhere right now, but we know whatever it is that we've got to do to fix that situation, we're going to fix it. So when those needs arise, we're going to take care of those. But in terms of any sort of new major initiatives, it doesn't seem like 18 is going to offer any opportunity to add much to what's in there today. Next fall, depending on how 19 looks, we'll be in a much more mature situation in terms of our analysis of what we have and what we need. And I expect that we'll be able to have the 19 budget be a lot more informed by what this product is going to give to us.
Thanks. I have one more quick question just to make sure I understand. I think it's slide 6. I think it was a good graphic, but I want to make sure I understand it. Here we go. I'll make a statement. You can tell me whether I understand what you're saying. How much you fund in maintenance and repair has a significant impact on how big the rectangle above it is, I'm assuming, because if you're doing enough maintenance and repair, then you might not need to replace assets so quickly or do major rehab as quickly. So it's important. They're not mutually exclusive kinds of issues. one has an impact on another. So I think the question that we'll continue to ask is to ensure that we understand that connection between maintenance and repair levels and whether they're adequate so that we're not building too large of a rectangle and a need above. Is that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is where we're going to get to. I don't think necessarily we're there today.
Right.
So eventually, that, you know, when we get into a, you know, regular, you know, paying attention to everything, that the box up above will be smaller, and, you know, it's going to be bigger now. Eventually, it's going to be smaller because if you're taking care of the thing, you're not letting it fall into disrepair prematurely. And therefore, it's the replacement or the major rehabilitation of that thing will be further out and therefore won't go into that box above.
So in other words, based on the work you're doing today, your knowledge and confidence on how big the blue and the red are in out years gets better and better.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
And all the initiatives that we're doing, you know, pay attention to what we have that Mr. Wiedefeld's putting in place for us are going to help us get to that point where we're getting ahead of things and not reacting to things.
Okay, thanks. Just wanted to make sure that I understood that.
Ms. Goldman. Mr. Chair, I'm not a member of your committee, but I did want to ask a few questions and see how
your
this
presence
process.
And your wisdom and your questions are always welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Just to follow up on Mr. Costa's questions, I'm trying to understand how this capital needs inventory will work into the work of the Finance Committee as it considers the capital budget for this coming year, FY18. And so in your next steps, you indicate that there's a phase one CNI report, which you're going to produce by November. First question is, does that have any impact on the budgeting process for the capital improvement program for FY2018?
Only to the extent that we find a fire life safety issue that needs immediate attention, immediate or near-term attention.
Okay, so, but in general, in terms of the big picture, we shouldn't look to that as providing any special solution. Or
not a magic bullet at this point.
No
right.
Magic bullet there.
Right.
Okay. The second question, which maybe it's I should address to the general manager, but I'll address it to both of you. Where in this process do you begin your negotiation with the jurisdictions on the capital funding agreement for FY18 and the out years? Is that in any way related to this CNI process, or do you have a date when you'll begin that process, since that will obviously impact the board's deliberation
sure.
on that?
Again, the CNI is just another means of giving us better information, and again, we're at the beginning stages of that, so we all recognize that. So in the budget that I proposed, the capital budget that I proposed in December, in effect, will be, I think that's the starting point for that negotiation. But again, I think what John said is, look, 18 is pretty much, we have a lot of stuff that's moving now. It's moving in 18, so there's not a whole lot, again, unless something comes up that we haven't seen. But we don't see anything significant out there, so it's a continuation of the program. You know, it's the 7,000 series, it's the bus buys, it's, you know, those things that are underway. And that's why we think, again, as this into the next year, as we get a little bit more information, as, in effect, the capacity is starting to open up more. But we have a sense, you're going to have a sense of what the level is going out. In these out years, there are going to be levels. You know, there'll be examples of types of projects. We know this type of work continues into the future, but we don't want to say, now for that project, it's at this point of money. I think that's just unrealistic. And most capital program does not do that. It's usually a current year and a budget year, and the other ones are more planning years. And so we want to instill that into the whole capital program process.
So is your objective still to negotiate a multi-year capital funding agreement with the jurisdictions?
I think so. I think the jurisdictions helps jurisdictions to, you know, obviously think ahead. Again, it's not like these things are going to disappear. We know the scale of what we're up against. So I think for those negotiations to occur now, I think it's important for the PREA funding to make sure that we're lining up for that as well, and also post-PREA funding. As we start to think, as that ends, it'll end in that cycle. So we want to force ourselves to think through that, I think, as well at the same time.
So the capital needs survey will more address capital needs in some out years, FY 20, 21, 22, in that period, rather than the more immediate FY 18 and FY 19?
Yes. Again, it's providing the, you know, the fundamental level first, based on age assessment only, not physical condition. And that's where John's talking about. That's the larger lift. And again, that's a mandate that we have to hit in 2 years. So we forced as much as we could for this cycle. We're going to keep pushing for the next one. And then even after that, we have to, and then get to an annual process.
Thank you. I think that helps scope out what the Finance Committee has to do for the next few months. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mecklenburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I have one question going back to the slide with the blue and the red maintenance and repairs. And to Mr. Costa's point, I understand that red line, we obviously want to the red section to be smaller and somewhat consistent. But just a point of information, when you look at 21, 22, it's actually, well, especially 21, it actually grows. So why is that? At this point, you know, you'll have Safe Track, you'll have the surges hopefully completed, and so why would it jump year, and in 22 still be larger? It should be, again, to Tony's point, it should, at that point, you would think it would start to shrink as opposed to grow.
This is just an illustration. It's not indicating that we have any numbers. It's just what we didn't want to show is a solid line at the same level for blue and red. We wanted to indicate that it's going to be a variable depending upon what we learn.
Okay.
So it's not.
So you're not anticipating.
No, not necessarily. But we just wanted to show that this is not. It's always going to be two, and then the other one's going to be one. It was wanted to let you know that it's variable over the course of the years, depending on what we know and learn.
Okay. I know. I was just sort of curious. Why that was a big jump there. If there's something you know that we don't.
No. Not at this point.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, you have a question?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for the presentation. I'm assuming this information is the information we're going to be supplying to Jeff and Dennis as they prepare their 10-year plan. And you're, I'm sure, familiar with the 10-year plan that was given to the board last at our last board meeting that outlines the capital needs for the system for the next 10 years, an $18 billion number that is really a $12 billion number because we don't have the capacity to do an $18 billion. I assume this is that information that is going to update what's already there.
No,
it's a continuation of that. Basically, what they did is they looked at old information that we had, right, and took pieces of that to create, Jeff did, to create his model. This now provides more information on that, and as it progresses, we'll get more detail to get into that, because that's what he said. He said, look, you know, this is what we know today, and that they're doing the CNI, and so they'll get more this fall. We'll get more after that, more detail. But his key point was that basically, regardless of what you eventually put in those buckets, they're very large numbers that we have to address. And then you got to look at the production capability. So that ratchets that down. And then his other major point is now you have to start thinking as a finance person, all right, how do you finance something like this?
Right.
These things last for 30, 40, 50 years. Do you have mechanisms in place to, in effect, do that rather than do it annually? I think that was his major points in his presentation.
Yeah. So this is going to give us, so I can understand this, the projects that we need to do over the next 10 years and how much they're going to cost.
It's going to give you another snapshot of basically the types of projects that we need to do.
Okay.
We're trying to back away from committing to dollars because, as John mentioned, I think that's where we've gotten into issues before. That's why we want to create this development program where we put in projects. We know that there's a large project out there, but we don't want to say that we're going to do it in 2024 at this number when we haven't done any of the engineering and all that work. So what we're going to do is identify those projects, put them into that. But you, for the scale that we're talking about, it gives you the scale, and I think that's what we've had in the past. It'll get more refined. But the numbers, as we all know, are huge, just like they're huge if you look at the education infrastructure or LAIF's infrastructure. You know, that's just the nature of the beast for sure.
Yeah. So and my final question is, when Jeff made his presentation, he said that he was expecting numbers in November, which kind of fits with what you put up there. So what we really need to have when we go to Congress and the surrounding jurisdictions is there's always a lot of pushback. And the governors, et cetera, always, the answer is, it's not specific enough, so I'm not going to give you the money. You know, there's always a reason not to give money. So by November, will we have the specificity to be able to put into the model so that when we present this model, we can say, this is what the money's for, and I won't run into the situation of people saying, that's a big number, and you can't tell me how you're going to spend it.
We will be able to basically identify the types of assets that need to be done. We have basically some industry numbers around some of those things.
Yeah.
So you know buses, you know rail cars,
right.
you know. So you can come up with a very defensible number,
okay.
Because you know the asset is running out.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we get to that level. But again, we're not getting at an engineering level. That's not what
right.
we're doing. We're not building a 10-year capital program. That's not what we're doing. We're building a, you know, a, in effect, a 2-year capital program that we can all agree to. And then the out years that we agree these are the types of projects we have to get to. And here's a scale of them. But now let's go do the detail and find out what we're committing to.
Okay. And my last comment then is, Paul, you made a very good point yesterday for those who weren't there. When asked by one of the governors, if this was a business, what would you do? And Paul pointed out, we have a 40, these numbers confirm that now, a $40 billion asset, right? A $40 billion asset. So if I had a $40 billion asset, I would do all I could to maintain the asset, right? And that was your comment, which I thought was an excellent comment back to the governors who were giving us a lot of pushback on why they didn't think we had to invest in this. It's a $40 billion asset that we are allowing to go to wreck and ruin. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Costa, you had another question?
I have a question. But it feels to me, for folks who aren't in this business, this is like the home inspection that you do when you're buying a house. You know you have a 15-year-old furnace, and you know that you're going to need to replace it in 6 or 7 years because that's how long furnaces last. And so you stick a number in there based on that replacement value, but you know technology might change, you know your needs might change, and so the number might change. But if we can start to have the conversation in that kind of way, that number in year six represents a replacement value, and then when folks start to say, well, are you sure that that's the kind of furnace you need? The answer is no. You know, we don't know if that's the kind of furnace we need 6 or 7 years from now. We just know, because we're doing good planning, that we'll need to do something. And as the years go by and we do better project development work, we'll test the technology. We'll give you a better number when we're ready to actually ask you for funding. And so I think that's the rhythm that we're talking about, and hopefully we'll begin to get that story across in that way. So it's not really a question.
No, actually, it's a great comment. Thank you, Mr. Costa. I appreciate that and your leadership on this issue as well. Any further questions for Mr. Thomas or the rest of the team regarding the CNI? Thank you very much. We appreciate it, Mr. Thomas. Now we'll turn to our second information item with Mr. Wonder regarding the radio and cellular infrastructure replacement update. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, distinguished members of this committee. Thank you for having me here today. I want to spend a little time with you this morning to give you an update on the radio and cellular infrastructure replacement project, give you some background about the project, the scope of work, talk about some of the timelines, and hopefully help answer any questions that you might have. The benefits of this project, at the end when it's done, will help improve access throughout the system. It'll enhance our reliability, and most importantly, it'll bring Wilmot in compliance with two acts of Congress. First is the Federal Rail Safety Improvement Act. It was passed in 2008, which requires Metro to provide customer service with wireless access. And then the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act, February 22nd of 2012, which requires all public agencies to vacate their T-band frequencies within 10 years. To give you a little bit information about the work that needs to be done as part of the project, I've kind of broken this down into three primary elements. The first element to talk about is the above-ground work that needs to be done. In order to build a new radio system, we have to put up new tower sites throughout the operating area. We anticipate that we're going to have a total of 28 sites scattered around the area. 22 of those will be co-located on existing buildings or towers. 6 of them will be new tower sites that we will build at various yard facilities throughout the area. And then we're also going to look at our 70-plus buildings to provide supplemental coverage. For the below ground, we have over 100 miles of underground tunnel that's going to require over 400 miles of infrastructure that needs to be put in. We'll be touching all the tunnel right-of-way, vent shafts, stations, and comm rooms. Then the third phase is to get actual radios installed in all of our fleet vehicles, which includes all of our rail revenue vehicles and non-revenue vehicles, our bus revenue vehicles and non-revenue vehicles, and all of our MTPD police fleets. Then we also have to distribute close to about 6,000 portable radios to all of our users throughout the authority. For the above ground work, first the contractor has to determine the tower locations where these sites are going to be located. Then our land group will have to reach out to those property owners and try and secure site leases for them. Once done, we can move the sites into construction, start applying for permits, look at any zoning issues for the new tower sites that we have, and then actually start site construction. And then we'll finish by putting the entire network on air once all the infrastructure is complete. At the same time, we'll also be looking to try and start the installation of the mobile vehicles in all of our vehicle fleets. This will provide coverage for our entire metro operating area. And we will go through and evaluate our in-building coverage in all our buildings and garages on a case-by-case basis. To talk a little bit about the work involved to get the underground portion of the work complete, create a little graphic representation for you. We're going to be utilizing all of our work trains and special high rail vehicles to help us access various parts of the tunnel. In order to get this system up, we first have to put a cable management system throughout all of the underground. We're installing this along the third rail side of the tunnel to give us ease of access for install. Excuse me. Then we have to install 2 radiating cables, one for our radio network and one for the cellular carriers to utilize for their backbone. We have to install fiber optic cabling and power cabling throughout the underground to service the equipment and to provide the backbone for communications. Our crews, our internal WMATA crews, are working with the carrier consortium also to help them get their equipment placed down in the vent shafts to complete the communication in the tunnel sections. And then our radio contractor will go through all of the stations and put the amplifier systems in there to complete. Our crews, because the work involves accessing the right-of-way, our internal crews will be doing all the installation for the radio equipment. So you see, there's quite a bit of work in order to get the radio system up. We brought in an outside consultant, Parsons Transportation, to help evaluate the project to see if there were ways that we could expedite it. They came in, they spent some time with our project teams and field crews to understand our processes and methodologies, and then they looked at 3 comparable projects throughout the U.S., one Chicago Transit Authority, one in Massachusetts, and another one Port Authority of New York, New Jersey. Each of those were taking on similar cellular or radio projects of various sizes, but were as close as they could and comparable to the size and scope that we have. From those evaluations, they gave us a list of recommendations that we can utilize to help increase our productivity. From that, based off of production rates, looking at crew service, and then comparing other projects that are going on, including SafeTrack, we developed a schedule that we are now sharing with you to give you an idea of how we're going to roll out the underground communications in the system. We have started with a pilot area to kind of test our methodologies, which is from Glenmont to Silver Spring. We're currently in the process of completing that. We also have a small section from Potomac Avenue to Stadium Armory that we actually expect to have on air with cellular service by the end of November. From there, we'll move through to Metro Center to Potomac Avenue. which we expect to have complete in the latter part of 2017, and then from there through Benning Road to Largo Town Center. Again, a short section, the latter part of 2017. College Park to Gallery Place will be the next section, delivered by the summer of 2018. Union Station to DuPont Circle, followed by the end of the summer. Metro Center to Roslyn by that end of September. Roslyn to Ballston by the end of the year, 2018. Pentagon to King Street in April of 19. Gallery Place to Southern Avenue by the end of 19. And DuPont Circle to Medical Center and Grosvenor to Weifling, wrapping out the year in 2020. It is important to note that we are looking at ways to try to continue to expedite the schedule as possible.
If I could just add one important point on this chart, the cell phone availability, excuse me, is when we give it to the cell phone carriers, correct?
Actually, the infrastructure installation complete date is the day when we anticipate having all of the infrastructure complete for the cellular carriers. The cell phone availability is the estimated date of delivery for the actual cell portion of the system. Now, WMATA doesn't have any control of that, but we are working closely with the cellular consortium to make sure that they get access down there with us so that they can finish hooking up their equipment to meet these dates.
Okay, but the point is we don't control that date. It's eventually
correct.
At the cell phone carrier.
That's entirely up to the carriers, I mean, yes. To date, we actually have close to 30% of the tunnel design work complete, and we actually have over 20% of the cable management system installed along the third rail site. And we also have about 1.5% of the total amount of radiating and fiber optic cabling that's installed through various sections of the tunnel. The first areas that we expect to have cellular availability will be from Potomac Avenue to Stadium Armory by the end of the year, and then Glenmont to Silver Springs by the spring of 2017. To understand the complexity of this project, wanted to talk a little bit about some of the interdependencies that we have in order to bring all of this together. Our internal crews, while doing all of the infrastructure right away, we are dependent on the cell carriers to provide us with materials and to get those to us in a timely fashion in order to meet those scheduled dates. So there's a lot of coordination with them. And then as well, we're also coordinating to bring their equipment down into the tunnel system. So there's a lot of work there to bring those two pieces together. For the 7800 megahertz tunnel communications, again, we're completing that work internally to get the backbone infrastructure in. And then we're bringing in a contractor that's building the rest of the radio system to analyze the work that we've performed in the tunnel, help us identify any deficiencies, and then so we can go in and take any corrective actions that are needed before we finally bring everything on air. For the equipment, the radio contractor is actually providing us with the bidirectional amplifiers. We are then going out to a systems integrator to help us integrate these amplifiers into a cabinet, which in essence we're trying to plug and play a device that will allow quick installation down into the tunnel vent shafts and hopefully minimize the amount of time that we need on track to get that piece of work done. But we are reliant on the radio contractor and the systems integrator to be able to get those pieces back to us so that our internal crews can complete the installation. We are also reliant on our work with the various jurisdictions throughout the area to bring on the 800 megahertz portion of the radio system and get their networks tied in so that they have reliable communications as well. For the cell piece, they need to come down into the system and provide not only the materials, but they are also part of the approval design process, which our engineering groups are communicating closely with them. And then they are coming down to do a final acceptance test on the carrier systems and then making any optimization moves as required. Talk about some of the risks. We do have quite a few that we're working to manage through. Of course, first and foremost is the project time frame. As we identified earlier, we have close to a four-year program for the underground tunnels. We understand that we need to try and bring that in as much as possible. We're also dependent on being able to secure tower leases at the 22 sites that we talked to earlier in the slide. we don't anticipate any major problems, but we are working with outside entities. The cable installation, the tunnel access, always continues to be a challenge. Even with us working with internal crews, we are trying to coordinate with other projects like SafeTrack to ensure that we're not causing any delays in their program and vice versa. The radio design for the tunnel is another piece. In order to move this project along in the time frame that we were given, we actually had to take on a lot of the engineering work internally. So in essence, WMATA is going to own the design work for the below ground. We have multiple contracts and multiple interfaces between those contracts that we have to continually work through between the cellular consortium, the radio contractor that will actually provide the radio infrastructure, and again, the various jurisdictions. Getting vehicles made available. Of course, bringing in the 7K rail fleet has certainly helped ease some of the restrictions on getting those cars, but we do have to take the cars out of service in order to get the radio work done. We can only take out so many without impacting availability. Same thing with the bus fleets. Getting frequencies, we have gotten commitments from the FCC and the Region 20 local groups on allocating those frequencies to us in the 700 megahertz band. However, we can't officially apply to them until we have the physical property addresses identified, and that won't happen until we secure leases. And then, of course, there are other risks as well. Next steps with the project, we're continuing our tunnel dash design effort and the tunnel installation work. We anticipate also awarding the 700 megahertz radio contract by the end of this year. And shortly thereafter, we'll start to work on securing some of these tower lease sites. We are also placing orders for vehicle radios right after award so that we can begin the vehicle installation as soon as possible. We'll continue our risk mitigation strategies for both the above ground and below ground. And we'll continue to work with our jurisdictional partners to get the 800 megahertz system up as quickly as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Wunder. Time for discussion. Any questions or comments? Mr. Medberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wunder, I'm curious, implications for the central communications system, or center, in terms of infrastructure, costs, capital projects related to this work. On slide 4 or 5, I saw there's new master sites and new consoles, I guess, that go in. Would that... Are those costs separate from the work you're doing now, or is that included into? It's all included.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Augustine.
Thank you, Mr. Wunder. I really appreciate it. I just would like to understand your role on this project and kind of like the project team that we have on an internal basis that's working on this. And then secondly, if you could just, we had a schedule maybe I guess like 9 months ago, and I would just like to know if we are on that schedule now that we had previously.
Okay. I'll make sure I address that in two parts, and if I skip something, please let me know. For the first part, I'm the overall project manager for the radio and cellular project. I'm overseeing all the work involved with both the below ground construction as well as all the work for the above ground and the vehicle installation. So I'm pretty much seeing everything through. I have a project management team that works closely with me, with dedicated professionals. I have our internal engineering group under Marshall Lepler, who is our deputy director over Comm Engineering. He's got, I think, 8 engineers that are working with him. We also have our force account, FACP group, under the direction of Joe Fowler. His team is directly responsible for the installation efforts associated with the below ground. He has a team of about 12 individuals, and then we are utilizing a staff augmentation contract of about 20 to 30 more to help with the physical installation activities in the tunnel. So that's kind of give you an idea of the internal crews that make up the project team.
I'm sorry, and that this is your sole responsibility?
This is my only
project. This is it?
Yes.
This is all you're 100% on it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much have to. As big as it is, I really don't have the bandwidth for much else. As to your second question, I believe that initially we were looking at, I want to say somewhere around 2019 for initial completion of the tunnel piece. When that schedule was put together at that point, the only portion of work that we really had solidified was the radio portion of work, which only included the one radiating cable. I'm sure you probably had the information available to you. We actually didn't get signed into an agreement with the carrier consortium until February of this year. So there was a whole additional scope of work that wasn't included at the time that that schedule was put together.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Strickland. So this question is, these questions come from chart 8, the schedule, the installation schedule. So after this year, it appears that you're clearly going to move from one to one. I presume that's because you're using the same team. It begs the immediate obvious question, could we not deploy more resources to facilitate this being done more quickly?
We are. We're definitely looking at that. You know, part of the issue that we were contending with up until recently was just getting all the available track equipment available to us, as well as operators, so that we can start breaking those teams out. As we go through the engineering portion is kind of one of the pieces that's going to help dictate how we're able to break this up. Our engineering crews are literally only about a step ahead right now in terms of getting the design work complete for the tunnels. We've deployed a new technology. It's called LIDAR scanning, which is doing basically a laser scan of our entire tunnel system. They're actually out in the system right now doing these tunnel scans. Our hope is that we're going to get 3D graphical representations of the tunnels that the engineers can use to help expedite the engineering process. As we get more and more of this stuff designed, we can start looking at how we can branch out the crews, maybe segregate it where we have one crew that's doing the cable management system and another crew that's coming back and doing the cable. So we definitely are trying to consider every opportunity.
So along those lines, you alluded to SafeTrack being a challenge. It would also appear, maybe this is a question for Mr. Wiedefeld, is it also not an opportunity to maybe coordinate some of that work when you do have complete access to an area? And I'm, you know, looking at a few of the scheduled items that are falling outside of SafeTrack remaining surges, and it would seem like it would be a great opportunity to coordinate a lot of work when access is pretty unfettered. Yeah.
We attempted that during the first part of the surges, and basically found that we were moving at different speeds. And in fact, we were getting in each other's way, so that's why we started to pull it apart. So I think it's one of the things that I heard apparently came up in an earlier meeting. We got to document the types of things that we want to be doing with these extra hours, and this would fit into that category.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsey. Ms. Goldman.
Thank you. Mr. Wunder, thank you for your report. It's very informative. In the 3 years that I've been on the board, this is one of the issues and projects that I've heard about continually, and it's good to see finally after 36 months that we're actually making some progress. So in your implementation schedule, which is the same chart, 39 of 44, this one, that Mr. Dorsey was referring to, and the installation is sort of in different places. It's sort of here and then in a different little spots here and there, but it begins in November of this year, and then it begins to pick up speed in April of next year. My question is, are you in charge of the implementation program as far as making customers and riders aware of which sections, when they're lit up and on, that riders will know that they now have Wi-Fi service, cell service, on a particular segment? Is that within your jurisdiction and implementation plan, or is that someone else's responsibility?
The cell carriers maintain preference to be able to put out to the general public when service will be made available. Again, it's, what we're providing is basically a neutral host backbone. Each of the carriers have to, in turn, hook their equipment up to that neutral host network. So that consortium is working to put that together. They really have the control over when that's launched.
Right. They have the control of when to turn it on, when to put the lights on, so to speak.
Correct.
What I'm asking is, are we planning to have announcements at Glenmont telling people, Glenmont to Silver Spring is now on, you can use your cell phone service? Are we planning to have, you know, maps online or in the stations that show people, you know, sort of this sector is lit up, this sector is lit up, so that people who actually get on will now know that they can use their cell phone on particular sectors.
We'll work with the cell phone carriers and our communications. I want him to focus on the delivery part of it, but we'll get our communications people to come up with a, you know.
Thank you. I hope we do that because I think it's kind of complex schedule, and we need to do something to let riders know when they actually have cell service on a particular sector or segment.
Agreed.
Ms. Costa?
I hesitate to ask this. It's kind of a follow-on to Mr. Augustine and Mr. Dorsey's question, and actually Mr. Goldman's also about the project management side. This is a really, this is a really complicated project. On one of the slides, and I don't want to go back to it, there's a mention of a project integration role. Are you the project integrator, or do you have, or have we hired someone to sort of keep looking at this project, look at critical path items, maybe even do some kind of shared savings? Can you find some ways to do this faster? If this is all in-house, I'm a little worried that I'm just a little worried about delivery. I mean, I've had some bad experiences in my lifetime, working projects like this.
Let me try on this one. So, as Mr. Wunder noted, this is a very high visibility project. So he gets a lot of attention from his supervisor, from me, and we're having almost monthly meetings with Mr. Wiederfeld. So his time in the spotlight is significant,
right,
in terms of making sure that he has everything that he needs, whether it's people or things, to make sure that what he's got laid out here as a schedule is achieved. So we're putting a lot of safety nets under and around him to make sure that he is successful. One of the advantages, so he didn't mention in his introduction, he actually worked for the carriers before he came to work for us. He has some knowledge there that we can actually rely on for parts of what we're doing here. So that helps as well. But we're going to make sure that we're, whether it's integration, making sure he's got enough resources, so forth and so on, we're not going to let him fail on this.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Costa. Any further questions for Mr. Wunder or the rest of the team? Thank you, Mr. Wunder, for the presentation. It was excellent. One small piece of business to circle back to, need to approve the minutes from the September 8th committee meeting. With that, can I get a second on that?
Second.
All those in favor of the minutes as approved, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. And looks like we are actually able to return 7 minutes break between our next meeting.
Very
Thank
good.
You very much.
Excellent.
We're adjourned.
Good job.
Yep.
Finance committee. Yep. Round them up. What do you got?
So the mayor's office is pretty much flipping out.
Hey,
you're
Christian,
the mayor's office is pretty much flipping out.
Do you have a second?
I'm asking here is when are we, is Paul going to?
Tonight, maybe?
Yeah,
when is
Paul
going to
wait? Yeah, and there we go. What are we doing about taxi stands? We need to demonstrate the right we have. Game plan. So, I mean, there's the only game plan that we could actually have would be a lot of have to put a whole bunch of buses down here. We destroy all those people. They'll spend $50,000 on that. We're going to spend $25,000 just operating on the skeleton service.
Right. I'm with you, Lee.
So we're going to wait until 12 noon and then go have lunch and hammer all until.
He told me yesterday, he said, it would be hard. He had to give the order at 9 o'clock. We could do it. I mean, you're really asking people who are working till midnight anyway to stay till 1 o'clock. So, mechanically, this is actually done.
It's ridiculous.
Right. So, it's us just convincing him to say, do it. But I argued till I was blue in the face. We need this. And I don't think the board, stricken is over.
Criteria-wise, it's not an annual license.
Once to the light.
Okay. Right, so sure. Oh, right. It's unpredictable. It's beyond the scheduling.
Good. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's no easy way for them to supplement the clusters. Many of these events they can add.
Absolutely.
Yep. It's not a local event. It's a
regional event.
They know where the people are coming from. They are from Maryland. So, depending on the system, I think there's not on the north. It's going to be very difficult to distribute the people onto the street. It's unsafe. You know, we have near misses. We have people struck on the CCLs, hit by cars out there. Just on a regular day,
right?
To take, you know, 30 to 40% of the attendees that use the metro and back out onto the street. I mean, it's, there's no parking capacity in the area.
Right.
I mean, a lot of these other events on the mall, there's downtown parking. You go to the parking garage.
Yeah. And even the Billy Joel concert, which was held in National Stadium, you had an opportunity to plan again. I mean, I guess that would be my argument. Where this year, it's here. It just happened.
We have a traffic and parking operations plan for the nationals that everyone has contributed to for decades. Nowhere in that plan is the removal of all the subsidy. Like, it's not a contingency that we've ever planned for. So. I mean, how many people, on a participant basis, you've got 42,000?
43,500.
But you also have, you've got to have 1,000 workers too.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Okay,
cool.
Yeah. She had another 1,000 on top of that.
I mean, some of these other, I mean, a concert, I guess they would say as well, concerts like that.
Oh, yeah. The only thing is you can plan for a concert. We don't have that many of them, but yeah, you can plan for the concert because you know the concert's going to happen. This is that. And again,
concerts also have a set list. You know how long
that
baseball game, even a football game, you know how long it's going to be. Right, well, over time, but the baseball game, there's variability on the length of duration of the game every single time.
Every time, right. If it goes real quick,
the whole place for 2 hours is 25 minutes. Right? Eventually, he gets tired. He's a baby.
You know when it's over, right? You know when it's done. But I think that.
What?
Today is October 13th, and this is a meeting of the WMATA Finance Committee. We'll try to get the preliminaries out of the way first. Has everybody had a chance to review the agenda for today's meeting? If so, I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda. Any opposed? All in favor, signify aye. Aye.
Aye.
And has everybody had a chance to review the minutes from the September 8th meeting? If so, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Second?
Second.
It is approved. Before we begin into the discussion, I just want to say I was out yesterday, of course, at synagogue for Yom Kippur yesterday, and in my normal annual prayers, I added two
special prayers yesterday. One was for success for the Nats tonight. In that regard, I hope that if they are successful, that when World Series time comes around, we can find a way to make an exception to our closing policy so that for those three games, what's that? Well, I'm doing what's now possible. We will do that, and hopefully we'll find a way to make it possible for people who go to the game, if the game goes beyond 12 midnight, to get home. So we'll look forward to being able to do that, and that my prayer will be successful, and the Nats will be able to go forward into the postseason tonight. And second, I made a prayer for the success of actions of this committee and the board as we take on these issues of the FY18 budget. I suspect that that'll be a harder one for the Almighty to give us benefit of, but I have that prayer in any case. All right, good morning. Now that we have the committee's administrative business and our business with the Almighty out of the way, I'd like to provide an introduction with some context to our discussion today before we begin the two presentations. The first item on today's agenda is to amend this year's operating budget, the operating reimbursable budget. That's the one for FY 2017 and the five-year FY 2017 to FY 22 capital improvement program budget to accept an $11.5 million grant in funding from the Department of Homeland Security. These funds will support projects to improve safety and security through a closed-circuit TV monitoring system, remote disabling technology, and for ongoing training and security planning. After that short item, which I believe will receive unanimous approval from the committee, we will continue our conversation on Metro's upcoming FY 2018 operating budget. And today's discussion will cover preliminary projections for expenses, revenues, and subsidy in advance of the presentation of the general manager's proposed operating budget next month in November. This will provide the committee with an opportunity to discuss the major factors on the FY18 budget and the options that we have before us in terms of closing an anticipated $275 million budget gap. I'll first turn the floor to Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Anasecki, for the first item on the agenda. Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Last summer, the Department of Homeland Security made available discretionary grants for which Metro applied. And last month, Metro was awarded $1.5 million to support additional security measures at Metro. Today, staff is here to request approval to amend the FY17 to 22 capital improvement program, as well as the 2017 operating budget to incorporate these amounts. So, in the past, WMATA has used DHS grants to complete major security initiatives. For example, we've used those for rail hardening, or security technology, as well as cameras at stations. With respect to the $11.5 million, we will use that to again add additional cameras at stations and complete the bus technology initiatives, as well as support ongoing anti-terrorism efforts. With that, Mr. Chairman, I recommend committee acceptance of the DHS grants, as well as the amendment of the operating and capital budgets to incorporate these funds.
Thank you, Mr. Anasecki. Any questions from any members of the committee? Seeing none, I'd like to entertain a motion for a recommendation from the committee to the full board to do the following: amend and increase the FY 2017 to 2022 capital improvement program by $5.8 million with $0.9 million in FY 2017 to support camera, security camera and BST installations, and to amend and increase the FY 2017 operating reimbursable budget by $5.7 million for the Metropolitan Transit Police Department training and security planning efforts.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? Hearing none. Could I recommend to the chair and staff that we set this as a motion on the consent calendar for the board meeting at the end of the month in lieu of the unanimity with which the committee is recommending it to the full board for approval? Thank you. Mr. Onseki, the next item, the FY 2018 operating budget, first crack at it. Go ahead.
Thanks again, Mr. Chairman. Our goal today is to review key facts and factors that would shape the FY 18 operating budget. Just a quick recap of the current operating budget. As this committee is aware, in 2017, the board did not increase fares or reduce service. Metro also left the level of jurisdictional subsidy at the FY 16 level. To balance the budget, therefore, Metro used management actions as well as shifting $97 million from FTA grants to make up for lower ridership and revenues. I should note at this point, Mr. Chairman, that SafeTrack as well as the care plan were initiated subsequent to the adoption of the operating budget. But to make up for the expected ridership and revenue impact of those, the general manager reduced operating the number of positions in the budget by 500, which were in the midst of completing. And so that sets the stage for FY 18. Starting from the FY 17 budget, three things. Low ridership, replacing the FTA grants revenue that allowed Metro to balance the FY 17 operating budget, as well as the base inflation adjustments with respect to the operating cost add up to $275 million, which is the gap that has been discussed with respect to FY 18. The first two elements, which is the FTA funds and the ridership impacts, add up to $159 million. The last one, which is the expense growth, as you can see on this particular slide, is composed of four key elements. One is the personnel cost. Second is the care activities. The third piece, rail car parts and maintenance. And the last piece, the inflation elements that I mentioned a little bit earlier. And we can go into a little bit more detail in a few minutes. So over the next few slides, what we intend to do is to discuss with the committee some options for balancing the budget and addressing the gap that you see here. On slide four, we present a set of options. I'm sorry. On slide three, we present a set of options that essentially reflect the stream options. The policy choices here, again, get you to a balanced budget, but some of these options may not be as realistic as some of the other ones that we'll discuss a little bit later today. But we have provided them here as an illustration of the challenge that both Metro and the region faces in FY18. For example, with respect to management options, we can balance the budget using this particular option, but that will require taking 23% of the positions of the budget. We could, another option is also increase in fares, which in this case would require 35% increase in fares or shifting 70% of the formula federal funds in order to balance the budget. So given the extreme nature of these options, there are additional options which you see on the next page. The proportional scenario for closing the budget will result in getting $55 million, again, from the same five categories. I should caution, though, that while this option seems relatively straightforward compared to the last option, extreme options, there's still significant pain involved here, particularly with respect to riders who will be facing both a major fare increase as well as a major ridership reduction at the same time. And in the current environment, putting a fare increase and service costs of this magnitude at the same time will certainly result in bad multiplying effects. So what are the options left? When we go to the next slide, we again use the same series of policy choices but with different dimensions to try and balance the budget. As I noted at the onset, Metro is currently in the midst of eliminating 500 positions, which will reduce the FY18 budget and contribute about $25 million to closing the gap. The general manager has also brought non-rep healthcare in line with the region, which in FY18 will contribute another $3 million. But on top of those initiatives, he has directed staff to identify $12 million more, focused on some of the initiatives that are listed on this particular slide. So collectively, this should contribute about $40 million of reduction, in addition to what has been done over the last few years in terms of helping to balance the FY18 budget. In addition to the management actions, there's also, as you recall, last year, Metro did not increase fares in light of the concerns over service reliability and ridership. While those concerns are still relevant today, raising fares remains an option in light of the size of the deficit that we're dealing with. So starting with Metro Bus, for example, at $1.75, the current Metro Bus fare is still relatively cheap compared to our peers across both the region and the nation. And so the proposal here will increase that by 25 cents and generate about $50 million, obviously with some impact on ridership. On rail, we do acknowledge that rail fares are generally relatively high compared to, again, our peers. But a 4 to 5 cents per mile adjustment on rail fares would generate about $20 million a year to help balance the budget. And under this scenario, with the increase in bus fares, Metro access fares will also go up to $4 in this particular case. But in addition to those, the general manager has also directed that we engage in other efforts to reduce fare evasion. So there are other things that will be done in addition to increasing the basic fares in order to reduce fares, to rather generate revenues from the fare category. With respect to service reduction, there are potential rail and bus service changes that could save about $25 million, but these changes will be across the entire system. On Metro Rail, for instance, the maximum headways could increase from 6 to 8 minutes in the peak, and in the off-peak, obviously, additional adjustments will be made to reflect the level of service out there. There could also be turnbacks, as well as closures of certain stations during the off-peak based on ridership and utilization. On Metro Bus, the reductions will focus or could focus on the least productive routes. Again, this will include both regional and non-regional routes and will be, again, across the entire region. So over the next two pages, I will show, just as an illustration of some of the stations that could be closed, again, based on ridership across the nation. I should point out again that these have not been, no decisions have been made in terms of actual station closings or actual routes that have been eliminated. But these are potential options that could be applied in order to reduce the size of the deficit. So on this particular slide, we've identified stations in red, and as you can see that's all over the region that could be impacted if that ends up being one of the options. And on the next slide, focusing on the green column, these are routes in terms of which routes are getting the highest per rider subsidy across the region. Again, this is not the entirety of the route, and this just these routes may not get us to where we need to be, so there will be additional adjustments in terms of specific routes that are beyond this particular point. you go to the next slide, this is a subject that this committee has talked about in the past with respect to the use of federal funds to support the operating budget. As you'll recall, historically, this board has used, Metro has used, about $31 million for the most part in supporting the budget, which last year increased to $97 million. A starting point in this particular case could be going back to the historical average, which is $31 million. And when you look across the nation, other transit agencies do the same thing. I mean, these are eligible preventive maintenance use, and our use is not out of context with the region. But in this particular case, going back to the $31 million could be something for the boards to consider. But the point I also want to make here is that the board's decision on this particular issue will not materially change the overall need for this organizational contributions from the jurisdictions. It's really a question of, you know, do you use the capital funds or do you get it from the operating side? But at the end of the day, the total what's driving this decision will be the overall need of the organization. So to summarize, if you start from the FY16 subsidy level, which is 865 shown in the horizontal line here, and go to the $275 million gap, which is the red line, under the proportional scenario, you could then take management actions of $55 million, another $55 million from FES, another $55 million from service, and FTA funds, leaving $55 million from the jurisdiction. That's one option. An alternate option will start from the same point of subsidy as well as expected gap, and then make a different set of decisions. In this particular case, again, getting $40 million from management options, from FES getting $35 million, $20 million from service reductions, and again, going, if you go back to the original construct, getting $31 million from the federal formula funds, leaving, in this case, a slightly higher amount for regional contribution. But that's one of the options that this committee needs to evaluate, which will then drive the recommendation that the general manager will be making next month. But even beyond that, if you go to the next slide, you see there's still a series of risks embedded in the budget itself. Obviously, the ridership continues to be a factor that we are all tracking. But we're also in the midst of several efforts to improve safety around the system, and to the extent that additional directives come down from the FTA or additional things are identified to be addressed, those are things that are, again, are not factored into the budget at this particular time. And of course, if you go to the next slide, you see that this is something that you've seen in the past with respect to the 10-year outlook. While management actions and the outcome of the collective bargaining will continue to impact this, ultimately, a stable financial environment will require much more than that. Will require some revenue growth as well as obviously some additional ridership improvements across the system. And lastly, I want to point out that while we have described the more immediate needs with respect to FY18, we still, this organization still has a big issue out there with respect to OPEC, which at this point is not funded. And that particular requirements, while not immediate, is something that has to be addressed at some point by this committee and this organization. With that, I will point out that obviously next month the general manager will be submitting his budget recommendations to this committee. And after that, in December, the capital budget will be submitted. And with that, I will take any questions that the committee will have.
Thank you, Mr. Anasaki. members of the committee, I think we'll be really looking at two issues for the rest of this conversation this morning. Try and explore with Mr. Anasaki the basis for the projected need for $275 million, because I think while we don't engage in zero-based budgeting, we have to feel comfortable that the gap that we have to close is of that size. And then we'll sort of explore some of the options for the way to do that closing. In that regard, I'm just going to distribute a little piece of paper to help you as we look at this, to give you kind of two other scenarios, a number of scenarios that we can look at to try and understand how we can close this budget gap a little more, assuming that we do have a $275 million budget gap. In those scenarios, I guess if you're interested in where the chairman's mark is or where the chairman of this committee would like to go, I guess the direction I'd like to suggest that the committee move is what I call a kind of an 80-80 mark, and that is that we, in terms of preventive maintenance, try to begin a sloping down of how much of the preventive maintenance is handled in the capital budget as opposed to the operating budget, and start moving that down from the $100 million that we had in the current budget down to $80 million. And the other 80 is an increase in jurisdictional subsidy, and $80 million represents about a 10% increase in the jurisdictional subsidies from what it is for the current year, FY17, and then the rest of the gap would be closed along the lines of the management actions presented by staff and fare increase and some service reductions. But let me let you think about that, and I do want to just start by asking Mr. Anasecki to take a look at your second slide, the pie chart that shows the estimated budget gap of $275 million. And perhaps you could talk a little bit more. You show a ridership revenue decline of $59 million, which when you look at the first chart, our revenue is about $900 million, so 10% of that would be $90 million. So this suggests, I guess, about a 7 to 9% drop in revenue. I appreciate if you could sort of provide the math for that as to why you're projecting such a significant drop in ridership from year to year, and how that gets you to a $59 million reduction in revenue, and then we'll move on to some of the other expense growth items.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. If I just add additional context, if you recall in FY16, when that particular budget was balanced using TIF funds of almost $30 million, and with respect to FY17, both 16 and 17, that the base ridership, base fare revenue loss in those 2 years compared to budget was around $60 million. And that was prior to SafeTrack. What we have seen, starting in June over the last few months, and you will be seeing more of this in the next presentation with respect to the fourth quarter, is that the ridership performance for the first quarter has been significantly worse than, as we expected, than the previous years. And if you recall with respect to SafeTrack, there was an additional ridership impact which was not built into the budget itself. Based on all of those factors, it is our expectation that the ridership numbers for, and therefore the revenue numbers for FY18 will be much worse than we projected, and therefore will lead to the numbers that we are referring to in this particular case, about $60 million. And frankly, it could be worse than that. Again, we are doing that at this point based on some of the information that we've seen, but with the expectation that there will be continued efforts on the rail system to improve service reliability, those activities will continue to have ongoing impacts with respect to ridership. As we've pointed out in the past, it comes down to whether or not how quickly riders will come back to the system. And as you heard from Dr. Fuller and everybody that testified here a month or so ago, there's no clear indication that we're at that point yet.
So what is the ridership decline that's being forecast from this year? Is it 7 or 8% or 9%? Is that sort of the number that you're projecting?
It will probably, again, at this point, we're in the 9 to 10% range. 6% of that being just the basic decline from what we've seen in the past,
okay.
And then an additional 3% or so based on the activities going on in the system right now.
Right. And then on these other elements that make up the $116 million in expense growth, could you just put some numbers, especially on the care plan, what the number is there and what that involves, and the inflation factor? We seem to be living in a time of very little inflation. Just wondering why WMATA seems to get a greater share of the inflation than some of the other businesses and sectors out there.
Okay. With respect to the general expense growth, there are basically three things or four things as I've highlighted them out there. If I start from the bottom up, with respect to inflation itself, the basic inflation numbers there are really about $10 million just for basic inflation. Then you have, as you know, there's Metro Access, which is also in that particular category. And there's about $7 million of expected both inflation as well as growth in Metro Access, which is driving that. So you add those two up, that's about 17. And then, obviously, when you see increased congestion on the streets with respect to bus service, that has an impact on Metro's overall cost. Because now it's taking a bus 5 minutes longer or 10 minutes longer to get to a particular destination. That, as well as the operating cost of capital, new capital projects, whether it's a new garage, which is either bigger or in a much further location, all of those have impacts. And so in the aggregate, that category is probably about 25 or so million dollars. Then you talk about rail cap patch. Earlier today, the board approved, authorized the Metro staff to continue to use operating budget to purchase cap pads. If you recall from last year, that cost us about 20 or so million dollars on the operating budget. That's part of this, and that wasn't funded. So that's part of this particular effort in this case. We've included about $25 million for that effort to make sure that we have cars that will serve our customers on a daily basis. And then the care plan. As I mentioned earlier, that was introduced after the budget was adopted last time. The components of the care plan, which you know are designed to improve our service and to be much more responsive to both the customer needs as well as employee needs, range from additional station cleaning, station signage, program, track quality inspections, working with maintaining how we station manager amenities, improving the condition of the environment in which employees have to work, and of course, you know, helping the team to improve productivity across the system with respect to how we align care vehicles, how we pre-position them to serve customers. All of those things are expected to cost around $30 million. And which are essentially the components. The personal piece, again, reflects primarily the longevity that we have already negotiated with employees that in which next year comes into effect. There's nothing you can do about it because that is already pre-negotiated, obviously. There's also an additional service to National Harbor, which will cost, I think, about $3 million, which is also in there. Those are the key elements. Obviously, there's some other things in there, but those are the key elements that drive that $160 million.
Thank you, Mr. Osaki. I think as we get into the full budget next month, these will be areas that the committee and the board will want to explore in more detail because to the extent that the gap can be reduced by a better understanding of some of these factors or some other efficiencies, that's less of a gap that we have to close and make up. But I did want to give the committee and board members some broad understanding of what the justification is for the $275 million increase. So now we'll shift and we'll, our conversation will assume that the $275 million increase is valid, and we'll sort of discuss and give some guidance to staff and the general manager as to how we can make that that gap and how we can close that gap, and we'll go from
there. I can't accept that. I don't think that we should make that assumption at all. I definitely would like to hear from Mr. Wiedefeld, because this is showing a downward spiral of sorts. I mean, where's the light? Where's the light? Is the light coming? Because if it's not, then we need to be having a very different conversation. I simply cannot just take this the way that it's being presented.
No, I don't expect you to take it, but I think you have to appreciate, Mr. Augustine, that the actual formal budget will be presented next month. And the purpose of laying out these options is to give the general manager some guidance as he sort of fine-tunes the budget for next month as to what are the board's concerns, and if there is a budget gap, what are the preferences among board members between fare increase, service reductions on the one hand, putting everything on the backs of jurisdictional increased subsidy, maintaining the present use of preventive maintenance, which, as Mr. Anasecki pointed out, is permitted by the FTA and is a longstanding industry practice. You know, how we sort of want to mix and max the options. So I don't want to say that we're not going to take a deep dive when the actual budget is presented into these expense categories and what accounts for the projected growth. But I think the general manager is looking for some general guidance from the board in preparing his budget as to if there is a big budget gap like he's projecting at the end of the day, how the board would like to see it closed. So I want to open up that conversation.
Can you respond, though?
Sure. At a high level, I can. I mean, on the preventive maintenance, you know, $100 million, that's straightforward, right? We move 95, and we got to make a decision there. The ridership issue, you know, that's the light at the end of the tunnel. We have to turn around the ridership trends. And the way that we do that is we have to provide reliable service. That's, you know, we do surveys to our customers, and I think it's 84% of what they say, what do I need? I need reliable service to have me use it more. To get a reliable service, particularly on the rail, it comes down to two things. It comes down to the track, and it comes down to the cars. So on the car side, a big portion of that answer is the 7000 series. We've increased the pressure to get more of those delivered. That's doing that. We're also going after the car maintenance process that we follow and revising that process. So that's all gone. So we're trying to get the cars to be more reliable when they're out there. The other side of the equation is the tracks. And as we've seen in the last week, and as you've seen since the derailment, we are revising our inspection schedule. We are finding things, and we are addressing them. Now, it would be ideal to address them in non-revenue service. Sometimes we cannot do that. So yesterday was a good example of that with the red line, with the cracked rail. Again, if we have more time to get out there and physically constantly inspect and maintain that, then that does not impact revenue service, which then increases the reliability of the system. So that's, you know, that's where we have to continue to put our major focus, on the cars, the new cars, the maintenance of the existing cars, and getting the track to perform. To get the track to perform, we have to do the work. We're not going to ignore the things potentially that we ignored before or didn't know about, and we're riding trains over things that we, you know, should not have. We're not doing that. And so we're going to fix them when we find them. Ideally, we want to do it in non-maintenance or non-revenue service, but if we can't get to that and we find these things through the day, then we have to deal with them. So that's, to me, that's where the light is. That's where we have to get to. On the CARE initiative, I mean, you can go online and see it's 160 initiatives in effect. And that was a combination of things that I heard from the stakeholders and of the broad stakeholders, and then from the customers. And it's a lot of the basics. You know, they want better lighting. They want better police, more policing. They want signage. They want cleaning. They want escalators and elevators, all those things. So literally in that CARE initiative, you see the list of things that we're doing. So we can pull back on those things, but I mean, again, that was trying to get at those things.
I'm not suggesting.
No, I'm just saying that's what feeds this number.
I understand, but what I'm asking you is, I understand that, but what I'm asking is, you're going through these efforts, which you know I fully support, mm-hmm. all of the efforts that you are going through. In June of next year, or you tell me, when does the trend stop going like this, and we get flat, and we start going up based on all of these investments, all of the work that you're doing to turn this ship around,
right.
such that we wouldn't have, that we would not be assuming that we're going to be down $60 million in 18.
Sure. And again, what we control is what we have to focus on. I can't control the price of fuel and things like that. But what we can control is the reliability of the cars, and we can control the reliability of the track. And that's what we're focusing on. And then these other portions in here are things that the customers also say that's important to them to use the system. Again, some of the things I mentioned in the care.
So are we expecting an increase, or are we expecting a decrease in ridership for 18?
For 18, we're expecting a further decline because we're not there in the cars. We don't have the 7,000s online by then. We don't have the track to where it should be. We basically are continuing to work through those track issues now.
Last one, I promise. When will the turn happen then?
I can't predict that. I can tell you is what we can do, which is focus on providing a better product, and that's what we have to focus on.
Thank you. We're going to move along. I just want to describe these four options from the chair, and then we'll go to Mr. Smedberg. I cut him off when he had a question before. Scenario one is basically the pro rata scenario presented in the staff slides. Scenario two is an assumption which keeps preventive maintenance where it is at the $100 million, and everything else sort of falls in place once you sort of do that, assuming that you're going to have a shared pain scenario. Scenario four was the other alternative presented in the staff, where things went down to on preventive maintenance to the historic $31 million, and then everything else falls into place, producing a very high added subsidy on the jurisdictions. And scenario three is just somewhere in between for that. That's your guidance, Mr. Smedberg. I've cut you off before.
No problem, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Quickly, Mr. Anasuki, on slide seven, what base assumption are you using if, say, we do move ahead with an increase on rail to get to that $20 million, given that discussion we just had about ridership? Are you using levels that are pre-surge, during the surge, or what you anticipate after the surge? What's your base assumption there to give you that $20 million if we're expecting, we know ridership has declined. We don't know when it'll stop. So what assumption are you using for that figure?
No, we're using the current levels, which means that the expected ridership loss impact will add to what we're seeing now. Look, the fact is when you increase in fares or cut in service, there is an impact. And the numbers, we can get into the numbers in terms of what we expect the ridership impact to be. But we're using current levels and saying if the board chooses this option, it will add an additional X number of riders who will choose not to use us as a result of.
So you're using assumptions. So you're using current ridership numbers.
Correct. Okay. Yes.
And then lastly, Mr. Chair, I know others have questions, but if you are soliciting comment here, I think the option of closing stations during off-peak, I think to me is would not be very high on my list, certainly, for a whole host of reasons. Understand everything has to be on the table, but I think it sends the wrong message about where we're heading as a system.
Thank you. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, I would like you to add a scenario five. It's the spokesman for the District of Columbia. The scenario that we support is not on here, and it's something I've talked about. So scenario five would be management actions, $30 million. I don't believe you can achieve $40 million. PM, zero. Fare increases, zero. Service reduction, zero. And jurisdictional subsidy, $245. And I'll speak very briefly to all of those. On the management actions, I see the personnel part and maybe another $5 million from the other two areas, but not
from the other areas that are on there. I don't think you can achieve that. On the PM, every one of you probably received this email today. If you haven't, you need to read it. It is clear from Congress that if we use any of that capital money, they will reduce our PREA money accordingly and puts it in jeopardy. So I'm telling you, if you want to go above zero, you risk a huge amount of money from the PREA. Fare increases, you know, our stand in the district on that, so we don't support fare increases, particularly fare increases on the bus. Service reductions, we don't support service reductions, so that gets us to the 245. So I'd appreciate that be included on your chart, because with that not on your chart, it really distorts where we are. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Rossi.
So a few foundational questions. So in terms of personnel, can you just give us a sense of where we stand on personnel today versus period of 2009, for example, which is the last time we had sort of sustained and consistent fare increases? So it's a question getting at whether or not we are right-sized for the level of ridership that we have right now. And I know it doesn't work linearly. You're not going to just reduce staff accordingly, but can you just give us a sense of where we stand overall as a size of an organization?
If you take into consideration the reductions that have been accomplished so far as a result of the general manager's 500-person position reduction, we are less, close to less than that point in time. Again, I want to put on the table the fact that all of the personnel obviously are not driving buses or operating train cars, but they are needed to support those who are, as you can imagine, with all of the construction or maintenance activities that are going on across the system. Some of these personnel has been brought on to support those efforts. But I can get you exact numbers in terms of where we are today. And when you add what the general manager has asked us to do with respect to FY18, it will take the overall personnel count down to down significantly.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just been reminded that actually, at the same time, the silver line was added to the system, so which required significant operating support, both in terms of driving, operating the trains as well as the yard activities to support those train operations.
I'd appreciate some specifics on that. I just think it's good for us to have overall comfort that we are fulfilling our basic guidance to make sure we're right-sized. Secondly, when it comes to fares, my brief look at fares historically and doing some basic inflation adjustments show that we're lower today than we were at periods when the system was created. I didn't look at every single year, but it looks like overall we are at a lower level, and that's been inconsistent with the way this board has supposedly gone about looking at fares to at least keep up with inflation. Is that your sense?
As I said earlier, obviously, bus fares are generally lower than peers on an inflation-adjusted basis. You're probably
not just
right.
Peers. I'm talking about WMATA historically.
On an inflation-adjusted basis, you're probably right, yeah. But I need to confirm that and get back to you.
I think that's important for us to look at as well. And then when it comes to the, how you phrase them, service reductions, I'm wondering if it's more accurate to look at these as service adjustments. And what's leading this question is to what extent are we actually, for example, when it comes to rail headways, to what extent are we actually meeting our reliability targets? And would, in fact, reducing headways, for example, just really right size and match what we're able to deliver right now? Or are these, in fact, true reductions that you're proposing here?
In some cases, you're right that the adjustments will reflect reality, but that may be insufficient to meet the need of balancing the budget along the constructs that have been advanced here. The point that I'm trying to make is that in some cases, we may make adjustments that are beyond the levels that obviously our customers actually experiencing currently on the system.
I think
and
it would,
certainly on the board side, yeah. I mean, the changes that we're suggesting on the board reflect, again, an effort to balance the budget. Again, in some cases, those reductions on boards will simply be transferred to the local jurisdictions with respect to non-regional routes, which means those services may not disappear. They just have to be provided by somebody else. And in that case, there's no net difference, if you will. But I don't want to leave you with the impression that all of the changes that are suggested here reflect our customers' experience currently on the system.
So I think that's important as we as a committee and then a board figure this out as we opt for options. You know, obviously service reductions sounds draconian and nobody wants to champion that, but where we're talking about right-sizing, reducing inefficiencies, actually matching what we're able to deliver, we need to segregate that out to show what is just meeting reality versus true changes in the customer experience. That's an important, not only semantic, but also a cost consideration as well.
Thank you, Mr. Percy. That's a very helpful comment. Other questions? Mr. Wilp, Bobby, and Ms. Carmen.
Thank you. Just a couple of observations here. The discussion on ridership is very important because some of the suggestions on ways that we can save money are going to drive down ridership. If you reduce service, you're going to drive down ridership. If you close stations, you're going to drive down ridership. And maybe you're counting on additional fares, but if you don't get the ridership, you don't get those fares. I mean, in extreme case, if we had zero riders, we wouldn't have any costs whatsoever. So anything, any decision that's made has to balance this ridership figure with what we can achieve. And I agree with Mr. Wiedefeld about the importance of making sure that we have a reliable system. But if we're going to drive the riders away with increased parking fares, increased train fares, less service, closed stations, we're never going to be able to turn that corner and start on the uptick again. In fact, and I think because of SafeTrack, and SafeTrack absolutely had to be done, I think because of SafeTrack, I think riders that we've had in the past we won't see ever again, because companies in this region are making adjustments to the style of work. They're doing telework. They're doing many things to take care of SafeTrack. And I don't think it's logical that when SafeTrack is over that these companies are going to suddenly pull that benefit from their employees. So I think ridership, any decisions that are made, ridership projections and that effect on ridership is going to have to be, you know, the major part of the conversation, because without ridership, you know, we don't have a transit system.
Thank you. Ms. Carmody?
A clarification. I'm looking at the slide called Closing the Gap, proportional scenario, where you have $55 million from five options. And you mentioned the first one being additional personnel reductions, 300 to 400. And further down, you have service reductions plus associated personnel reductions. Is that intended to be in addition to the 400?
Uh-huh. Obviously, and the reason why you see that is that depending on what you're planning and how you're planning there, additional costs associated with that. And just to put that in perspective, because of the, if you take a 50% equipment ratio, that means you have to buy $100 million. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure it's imprecise, but I would assume that even without service reductions, if you drop 400 positions, you might need to reduce service anyway. I mean, if you're dropping that many people, that's, I think there's a nexus there between cuts, but I'm wondering how precise that is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And also, do you account for the loss in revenue which would occur with service reductions? And that's part of the... All right, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Costa.
Actually, my question is for you, Mr. Chairman. We don't have a lot of time left. What was your expected...
We never have enough
what
time.
Was your expected outcome of the session? Because it felt like it was going to be a little bit of a working session for clarification, but it's now turned into a lot of discussion about positions.
Yeah, it was
supposed to be... And this whole discussion is really about three different pots of things, assumptions used, choices, that, you know, kind of discretionary pieces, and then things that are not a choice and not and not and are hard assumptions like contracts. And we seem to be all over the place. And I understand why. It's a complicated budget with hard choices. But I'm trying to understand ultimately what your expectation is or what your what outcome you're looking for the committee to get to today.
Well, as you pointed out, this is a work session. So it was intended to give some further guidance to General Manager and the Chief Financial Officer and staff on assuming that there is a very major budget deficit of this magnitude, where board members would like to see.
Individually or as a committee?
Individually, I think,
okay.
At this point. And I think the chair, Chair Evans, has stated unequivocally clearly where his position is and where the position of the D.C. government is. And I think it would have been helpful to have had some other positions. I'll tell you my view, as I've indicated, is that we need to have a solution with some shared pain. We're all stakeholders, riders, jurisdictions, and staff feel some pain if we're going to get to closing a budget deficit this side. I frankly think that... the scenario one, the pro rata scenario that staff laid out, isn't very practical or reasonable, and I think for the same reason, the scenario number five that the chair has pointed out is not very practical or reasonable. I just don't see Maryland or the Virginia jurisdictions coming up with $70 or $80 million to fill this hole unless they're convinced that LaMotta has done its share to try and take some actions on its own to close the belt, and fair payers are going to make some contribution to closing this gap as well. I think to try and convince legislators from Baltimore County and Cambridge or Hagerstown that they should support another 70 to 80 million for WMATA in FY18 is a, it's not going to happen. And so we need to find something that's within a realm of reasonableness for all the elements that are out there. And I've tried to suggest where I think we should be coming out, but I think the other members have to give staff some guidance as well.
So it's not really a working session. I mean, we're providing individual opinions.
Yeah, we'll have a work session, a real work session, once we get the actual operating budget that the general manager will present next month in November.
That was going to be my following question.
Yeah.
So we'll get this proposal, assuming that general manager is getting direction in some fashion by us individually,
right.
In the hallway, in this room. Okay. Thanks.
Yes. Any other questions? Mr. Augustine.
Michael, then I have a question. So in this presentation, you have this slide here talking about closing 20 stations during off-peak. You don't, though, really make really clear, it's not on the previous slide, and it's just kind of fallen in there. On the previous slide, you talk about off-peak service and closing station entrances, but then you throw this slide in there. I mean, what is this? What is that? And is there some, I mean, the dollars, or what is that?
This is an illustration of some of the stations that could be subject to closure during the off-peak based on the level of ridership at those times. Again, it's an illustration. No decisions have been made with respect to each station. But as I did on the next slide, just to identify some options.
But you have no dollars or anything. I mean, what is...
What we do have are ridership numbers, which is It is a question of, you know, how many customers are using those stations during the off-peak.
I guess I'm a little troubled that you would put such a dramatic slide up like that. I mean, that's a very dramatic slide, and not have some numbers or something behind it to support why you would put that even on the table.
Well, there are no good options on the table.
It's not about options. I mean, this is very serious. I mean, lots of people are very concerned about this slide, and for there not to be some financial numbers that are behind it, okay, I'm concerned about that.
Thank you. Ms.
Hudgens? We can certainly provide what you need.
Ms.
Hudgens. I think we're concerned because there's not a lot of specificity to this, but I think I want to go to the point where Malcolm is, and put it in a different context. As what I understand from what you've presented us in looking at these numbers, are there opportunities to save some cost and be able to still run the system to some level of service that's acceptable? And I'll give you the example. We run through Arlington National Cemetery all the time without stopping. Not all the time, but that's part of the route. I would think that if we were able to have it a little bit better clarified, for example, there are places that I've ridden the train from one end to the other, and the train stops, and no one gets on, and no one gets off. And those are the contexts that I think we need to try and put this in so that the general public understands maybe the level of service that the overall system will have will change, but the level of service in some places where there is revenue cost to no gain, do we look at those in order to understand and be able to recover that in terms of what the budget is? Because I think one of the things that we have to acknowledge, the service delivery that we have thought we were accustomed to does not exist today, and we're going to have to figure out what is the next level. I think we have a growth pattern that we've got to decide what is the next level is considered the best level of service that we can gain until we find a revenue source to change the system in a way that it's back to what we've become accustomed to. So I wanted to respond to that because I don't agree, for example, that we should absolutely have no fare increase. That's kind of pushing the envelope an awful lot, and a lot of people have said it, but the reality is you're not going to be able to get maybe as much as we would like from the subsidy piece. I think there has to be some give and take on all of these if we're going to get to a point where those listening to us recognize that we're trying our best to deal with what is not, well, I might say, I start to say not our norm, but maybe it is our norm, that this is a underfunded service. This is a service that is not up to par with our customers, and thus we need to find some happy medium in that to see what they are, and I think we should start thinking about them a little bit differently. So I have a view that, yes, I think a small increase to the rider, if they can continuously see the work that we're doing, may be a valid and acceptable fare increase. But I think we have to decide whether or not SafeTrack and the rest of these things are going to help us get back. And I would say that, yes, I think in some jurisdictions people are going to not, from a subsidy standpoint, say, there's a huge investment coming here until we are able to say there is an improvement here.
Thank you. We're reaching the end of our capacity. Recognize Ms. Porter, who hasn't spoken, the chair, and I'll bring some concluding comments, and hopefully we can stay on our schedule.
I want to follow up on Mr. Lobby's comments about the interaction between fare increases and ridership. Just to clarify, I believe you have included an estimate of decreased ridership due to the fare increase when you're calculating the savings from the fare increase. Is that correct? Are you doing the same thing with the service reductions? Are you calculating an estimate of the decrease in ridership that might be caused by service reductions when you're figuring the savings from the service reductions?
That's correct.
Are you assuming that there's an interaction between those two, that doing them together might also result in a larger fare increase than each one of them separately added up?
Yes, we are, which is why I expressed the concern with respect to the proportional reductions, that interaction will result in a far significant impact on the system compared to what they would be individually if they're not taking place at the same time.
Let me just put out two things, and we don't need to resolve them today, but one thing is that I am concerned because in the past our estimates of impacts on ridership have been not sufficient. We have seen ridership go lower than we projected based on changes and based on year-to-year comparisons. So I'm a little bit worried about how accurate those estimates of ridership impact are. And the other thing is, it seems to me that ridership is one of the hardest things to get our minds around and yet is absolutely essential to all of this, except perhaps the management things. And I wonder, and I offer this as a suggestion to the chair, maybe we should take a little bit deeper dive into the ridership issues when we're talking about the budget as a whole.
Thank you.
This is a question. Yes, thank you. Since most of us, including myself, are new, I'm still trying to understand this process. And so in response to Mr. Goldman's comment, I have this question for Mr. Wiedefeld, which I raised yesterday. If at the end of the exercise, the board votes a budget, and the budget requests an increase of a subsidy of, I'll just throw out numbers, $90 million from the district, $90 million from Maryland, and $70 million from Virginia, and we send that bill to those jurisdictions, do they have to pay us?
I think, again, the board would have to decide that that's what they would all want to do.
If we all vote for that, do they have to pay us?
My understanding is what we would do is we would put it into the individual they would have to put it into their budgets for consideration, not that they have to pay us, is my understanding.
Okay. So they don't have to pay us?
No. It goes into the Maryland General Assembly, the governor's budget. It goes to the Maryland General Assembly, and that goes through that whole process. Virginia, it has different levels of that, and the district, I'm not, you know, better than I, but I believe under the compact, I believe this is the way it works, is this board approves a budget that then goes into the budget processes of the jurisdictions. It has to be considered.
It has to be considered, okay. And then my second question is this.
Well, just to clarify that question, what you were saying is an additional 80 or 90 million.
Correct.
On top of the 845 million that the jurisdictions are paying
right
in this fiscal year.
Yeah. If we send a bill to the district instead of for 334 for 434 next year, do we have to pay? What if we say, no, we're not going to pay you? I mean, what happens at that point? And that's a rhetorical question. I don't need an answer for that right now, but what happens when that happens? And then secondly, in the district, we have a five-year plan. So one of the things that would be helpful to me going forward is if we ask for an additional $100 million from the district this year, in next year, will that $100 million cover the ongoing expenses? It looks like from what you presented, it will. We have a $100 million increase in the safe track. So if we give you an extra $100, that'll cover the expenses going forward, and you won't have to come back next year and ask me for another $100 million increase. Will we have something that shows that?
No, you have something in that 10-year graph, I think, shows you that, you know, there's other factors that impact that growth rate.
Yeah, no, I understand, yeah.
So,
is there a way of getting and I'll stop here, it's like a three-year projection, like we get a budget for 18, but 19 and 20, rough numbers, so I know what I'm dealing with in the out years. I don't know if we do that here or not.
I'm not the lawyer.
Okay, that's all.
All right, we're reaching the end of our time. I'm sorry, let me just make a comment then. I just want to make three comments as we conclude this inconclusive conversation. In terms of fare box recovery, I think we have to keep in mind that right now our fare box recovery rate is less than 50%, so we're recovering 45%. So of every dollar that we spend from the fare box, we're only recovering 45 cents. And if you'll remember the McKinsey presentation, the industry norm is somewhere about between 50 and 55%. All I'm saying is there seems to be some basis for our wanting to keep fares in line with inflation and on a periodic basis raise. Can I, well, you then go back and look at the numbers, read the report. Second of all, on station closings, while this is sort of like the closing the Washington Monument or the Smithsonian scenario, isn't there a more middle ground scenario where we keep the stations open but reduce the staffing at the stations so that people can get on and get off at the stations, but the trains can still move through, people can go through the turnstiles and get on and off? I just raised that for your consideration as you come back. Final thing on the reductions on buses. I would urge especially the jurisdictions to take a real close look at that slide number 10, because some of those numbers are certainly eye-popping, where you have routes where the subsidy is $14 per rider, you know, 13, 14, 12, 13, 14 is for someone paying $1.75. That seems like a very high level of subsidy for a service, and some of the total subsidy amounts, you know, $3 million, $3.5 million, just seem very large. There seems to be some targets out there that we should be taking a hard look at cutting, and the jurisdictions should be looking at whether they can pick up some of those routes at costs which may be less costly than it costs WMATA to serve it because of their wage rate levels or because of their size of their buses or because of the distance between the route and coming back to their bus terminals. So I would encourage you, all of us, jurisdictions, as well as board members, to take a hard look at that. Mr. Dormjo.
Thank you. I would just request that we place a parking rate increase on the table and at least quantify that. I understand there's an RFP that's underway, but I think if everything's got to be on the table, a parking rate increase should be on the table as well.
Very good. Well, I hope we've given you some inconclusive guidance, and we'll look forward to a very precise, well-presented operating budget in November that we can take pot shots out. Thank you very much.
Thank
committee
you
meeting
back.
Is adjourned for,
go
no,
back to
for
the
October.
Synagogue. You need some more help. he didn't listen to you.
No. You Almighty is slow in responding, but not everything happens. It's not instantaneous.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's not like your. It's not like Google or.
I'm glad you explained that.
Why don't we ask people to step outside?
Yeah,
since they're interviewing.
Step outside.
Yeah.
Please step outside.
I'm not a member of your committee, but I may participate in the state.
Yeah. Why don't you ask too many questions? No, I'm teasing. Okay. Okay. Okay.
All right, what am I supposed to do here? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, and we're going to try to get back on time. How much time do I have, Jennifer?
30 minutes.
Okay, we've got to power through this clearly. Is there a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Ayes carry. The minutes, approval of the minutes of September the 22nd, 2016. May I have a motion to have those approved?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those say no. Okay. Fine. Great. Okay. Just a few comments here. Procedurally, we're going to ask Patricia Lee, our general counsel, to brief us on the bylaws and ethics recommendations. We're not going to take action today. This is very for informative purposes only. In the interest of time, and no disrespect to non-committee members, as let Patty make her presentation in its entirety, then we can take questions afterwards. And then I'd like to prioritize the questions, if possible, to committee members, and then we'll go to the other members of the board that are here. So, Patty, thank you very much, and would you carry on from here? Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Price. The revised versions of the bylaws and code of ethics provides an efficient, high-level description of how WMATA's governance works and amends specific provisions to promote clarity and conciseness and to align with the best practices of modern-day bylaws and ethics codes. As requested by the WMATA Board of Directors, I had a conference call with the Attorney Generals of the three signatories. We had a thoughtful and productive call, and I have considered all of their comments in this revised version of the governance documents. In a few minutes, I'll take the board through some of the comments and how we've addressed them in the documents. These revised bylaws and code of ethics are a culmination of efforts by a multidisciplinary team of internal and external partners, including the strategic advisor Jones Day. We believe they represent best practices that will assist the board in performing its policy, financial direction, and oversight functions, in addition to assisting board members in navigating ethical issues that may arise in performing their duties. The staff recommends that the board adopt the revisions, but I understand that this is currently just an
information session.
Purposes. Yes. And so right now, I'd like to take you through some of the comments of the AGs and how we've addressed them. So I had a conference call on October 7th with the Attorney General's offices of the three signatories. They gave me comments. They focused mostly on the ethics code, mostly on two issues. And the first is the issue of the dual fiduciaries. So if you turn to the ethics code, Article 2, you will see that we've left the dual fiduciaries, the idea of a dual fiduciary in there, and we just made a few minor changes per the request of the Attorney Generals, which does not, again, change the substance or effect of the dual fiduciary nature of the board members' roles. The second comment that they had was regarding their duty of confidentiality, which is also Article 2, B as in boy, and that was the communication with the executives in their government. And you'll see that that section is unchanged. You'll notice that in the prior recommendation from Jones Day on September 22nd, they had highlighted. They didn't recommend changing it. They just highlighted as a comment. And so that section is unchanged. They also talked about previously in the Jones Day version of the ethics code, you'll recall that there were a lot of comments about MWA. They made it very clear to me that they don't want to model this after MWA, and I confirmed for them that this is not modeled after MWA. MWA was... the Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority. And I reminded them, or I confirmed for them, that MWA was only one of seven transit authority documents, governance documents that they looked at, and it wasn't the sole one. But as a result of that conversation, they asked me to take out certain recommended changes or highlighted changes that weren't essential and they were sort of just nice to haves. And so that is also reflected in this current version of the ethics code. They didn't have any comments on the bylaws during the conference call. After the conference call, I did receive a call from one of the jurisdictions, and one of the sections in the bylaws that they raised some concern with is Article 4 in the bylaws, which is the ability or the authority of the board members to delegate to the general manager the authority to appoint and remove officers. And I explained to them that my reading of the compact, in fact, gives the board the authority to delegate that. And it's Section 9A, as an apple, of the compact. And I explained that, and in fact, the board has so delegated that on three separate occasions in 2007, in 2012, and in 2014. And so that was really the only comment they had on the bylaws. If there's any questions about that section of the compact. Yes.
A clarification on that. Article 4.
Excuse me. I said I want to go to the committee members first, and respectfully we'll then come to you. Any committee members have any questions? Please, Paul.
Yes. There's a lot of discussion now about the safety commission or the safety, this new tri-jurisdictional safety board.
Mm-hmm.
Did that ever come up at all during your discussions with the attorneys general as it relates to the
to the bylaws?
Is it going to impact the bylaws at all?
It did not come up at all. They didn't raise it at all.
Do we anticipate it could potentially impact the bylaws at all? I mean, I know there's a lot of discussion going on about it, and there's been a lot of talk.
Right.
So will it ultimately have some impact on the bylaws potentially?
I don't believe so. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Phil.
I think it's possible that the bylaws may need to reference it, but from what I understand about the safety commission right now, it wouldn't change the board's bylaws.
Okay.
Right. So the safety.
We had a fairly detailed briefing at the last NBTC meeting, and I think it's fair to say it potentially has some impact on what, you know, how WMATA addresses certain safety issues potentially.
Well, I mean,
in a more direct way.
Right. So the bylaws are consistent with the compact. So if this new safety commission were to require, for example, an amendment to the compact, and that might change something, then yes, we would definitely have to look at it.
Okay.
Or if it were to change the role of the safety committee, which is also specified in the bylaws, that's the sort of adjustment I was thinking about.
Okay. Yeah, because I was thinking, hearing the presentation, I just sort of wondered if.
It was not raised.
Really?
Yeah, at all.
Are there any other questions from committee members? If so, please speak up.
You discussed the Section 9A that I believe that you were starting to talk about. Could you finish that line?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So if anybody would like a copy of the compact, I have them here. It's also in your... it's also in the diligent. So in Section 9A, you'll see that in the third sentence of Section 9A of the compact, it says, all such officers shall be appointed and may be... 9A of the compact? Sorry.
She's passing out copies of the compact.
yeah, let me give you a moment to have the compacts passed out. Okay, so in section 9A of the compact, in the third sentence, it says all such officers shall be appointed and may be removed by the board, shall serve at the pleasure of the board, and shall perform such duties and functions as the board shall specify. If you then move, though, and read the last sentence in 9A, it says all employees and such officers as the board, may designate, shall be appointed and removed by the general manager under such rules of procedure and standards as the board may determine. And so it is that last sentence that I believe gives the board the authority to delegate certain officers as the board deems appropriate to the general manager to appoint and remove.
Any other questions? Okay, Kathy, please. I'm sorry.
I'm confused about this particular section.
Okay.
As I read it, you're making a distinction between board officers and WMATA officers. Is that correct?
No, I'm okay. Sorry. I'm just talking about WMATA officers.
But so when you say WMATA officers, mm-hmm. The first part of that section, it says board officers are, and then you say WMATA officers are. Are those two separate lists of people, or are they all the same?
There's two separate. In fact, a board member cannot be a WMATA officer.
Right.
Yep.
And so when you say the general manager can appoint, does the general manager then appoint board officers? The general manager appoint board chair, vice chair?
No.
Okay. So, I think that is what's caused some confusion. Maybe if you could clarify that you're talking about two separate groups of people, and the general manager does not, in fact, appoint the chair of the board, the vice chair of the board, or those folks.
And I did, in fact, make that change. So if you look at the version of the bylaws that was sent up last evening, I in fact, made that change. So it's on page 4 of the bylaws, Article 4. It says officers.
Okay, Article 4.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Officers.
Yep.
So it now reads, the officers of the WMATA board shall consist of a board chair, a board first vice chair, and a board second chair, full stop. And then it says, each board officer shall hold office until his or her successor is elected and qualified, or until his or her earlier resignation or removal, full stop. Then it says, the officers of WMATA shall consist of a general manager, a secretary, an inspector general, a general counsel, a chief financial officer, a treasurer, a comptroller, and such other officers as may from time to time be created and appointed by the general manager. So that was made, in fact, in direct response to the issue that was raised. And it was that last phrase that from time to time can be created and appointed by the general manager. That was the phrase they had concern about, and they thought that that applied to board officers.
Right.
But now that I've separated all the sentences, that clearly only applies to WMATA officers.
Okay, I don't know. It still seems somewhat confusing to me. I don't know if other people have the same reaction. But if everybody else thinks it's fine. I have a couple of other things that I wanted to mention.
Please. Are there questions?
They are clarifications. Let's see.
Now, keep in mind, we're going to take this back to the various attorney generals, and they're going to vet this again.
Right. That's why these are clarifications. Let's
sure.
see.
I mean, so, Ms. Porter, if you'd like, I can split number one and have a thing that says board officers and WMATA officers. So it's very clear that the sentence applies.
To me, that seems clear, so I would appreciate that.
Okay.
The other thing is under Article 2, Section 11.
Of the bylaws?
Of the bylaws.
Okay.
All mine are on the bylaws.
Yep.
Under alternate directors, it says an alternate director may be counted toward a quorum for a board meeting, may participate in an executive session, and may vote at a board meeting only in the absence of the director. It sounds like alternate directors may not participate in executive sessions on a general matter.
I'm sorry.
This is Article 2, Section 11.
On the alternate directors?
Yes.
Right. And you're saying that it sounds like they can't participate in what?
The sentence is, an alternate director may be counted toward a quorum for a board meeting, may participate in an executive session, and may vote at a board meeting only in the absence of the director.
Right. And that is as required by the compact. So if you read, an action means an actual board action, and under the compact, right?
May participate in an executive session. That's what I'm asking about. Is the intention of that sentence is that alternate directors may not participate in executive sessions?
No, that is not the intention.
Okay.
I don't want to speak, but I think you solve her issue just by putting some periods in there.
Right. Thank you, Christian.
Go ahead.
Okay. And then the last clarification I had was Article 3 committees.
Okay.
Section 12, committee meetings.
Okay.
It says a quorum requires the presence of a majority of the committee's members. Mm-hmm. Is that intended to not consider the jurisdictions that the committee members represent? In other words, if you have a four-member committee, mm-hmm. three of those members would constitute a quorum.
Yes.
But if not all the signatory jurisdictions were represented by those three members, is the intention that that would still represent a quorum?
Yes.
So this is a change from the way we do it now.
Yeah. So the way the current bylaws are written is that, my understanding is that it referenced the quorum section of the compact. And the quorum section of the compact does require one from each signatory. But that was never intended, in my reading, to cover committee meetings because the compact doesn't address committees. The compact left it up to the board to create its own policies and procedures. And so it's up to the board to create, they may or may not create committees, and you have. So it's not necessary to use that as a quorum. And I think it makes efficiency, effectiveness sense to just say if you have a majority of the committee members that show up, then that should constitute a quorum for committee purposes.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that that is a change from current practice.
It is.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one concern and one comment that I would like to relay both to staff and the members of the committee, and that has to do with, I guess it's Section 9 that deals with the executive sessions of the board.
Mm-hmm.
My concern here is that there's a change here in that, as I recall the current language, there were some suggested limitations on what can happen at executive sessions, and I would urge the committee to restore that language back into the provision dealing with executive sessions. I say that because I think, while it's not a legal matter, and I take what the special counsel has advised as to what the compact requires or doesn't require as a correct legal opinion, I think as a policy matter, we want to err on the side of transparency. And I think the presence of language which limits or suggests limitations on what can happen in an executive session to confidential personnel issues, contractual matters, contractual bargaining negotiation issues, sensitive business information, and kind of litigation strategy and litigation matters, is a good policy guideline that we should have as board members. I say this particularly because I thought we aired a couple weeks ago with a presentation by the District of Columbia's chief financial officer, which I thought was very interesting, but there was nothing in it. It was just a lot of numbers and theories, and it shouldn't have been something that was presented in a confidential format. It should have been presented in a broadly transparent public environment, either as a finance committee or the capital programs committee or some other committee of the board. So I think putting that language back in will give us some good guideposts, and I would urge you to consider that, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Staub probably knows, I suspect that language has been in the bylaws for many years, certainly preceding my 3 years, and it's been something that has been good guidance for the board for many years, and I think it would be good guidance to be retained and reinserted going forward.
Yeah, thank you for your comments, and that's one of the items that we're considering when we talk to the attorney generals going back and so forth. So that's a good catch.
Thank you,
Tony. Please. I can't hear you. I'm sorry, I'm hard of hearing.
I need to press that button.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Sorry about that.
I do it all the time.
Question regarding Article 2, Section 8 on quorum.
Okay. Yes.
There's deletion of the Secretary of DOT.
Right.
I'd like to understand why that was deleted. And then,
okay,
because it's deleted, mm-hmm, the sentence doesn't make a lot of sense, at least to me.
Okay. So the reason it was deleted, it shouldn't have been in there in the first place, because the way the compact reads, when the federal members were added to the compact, the legislation did not amend Article 8A of the compact. And so Article 8A remains unamended, and so Article 2.8 of the bylaws has to reflect what's in 8A of the compact, which is that a quorum shall consist and no action.
Page is that on? So
I'm sorry.
Three.
Okay. Page 3 of the compact.
That's fine. No, okay. I have it. I was just putting it in other numbers.
Yeah, it's page 3 of the compact, 8A, as an apple. And so it says four directors or alternates consisting of at least one director or alternate appointed from each signatory. The federal government is not a signatory to the compact. And so that's why it shouldn't have been in the version that Jones Day put up on September 22nd. We caught that, and that's why we've deleted it out.
So then how would that actually work then? A quorum requires the presence of four directors.
Mm-hmm. And, okay. So there's eight principal directors, right?
Yes.
So if the eight principal directors want to have a meeting, a quorum is four. So as long as four members show up, the board can take action, okay?
So the feds don't need to be there?
They don't have to, but they can be. And and
I was looking for now.
And so the way the quorum works is, so say only four board members showed up for a board action meeting. Three of those four have to be, one has to be from D.C., one has to be from Maryland, and one has to be from Virginia, because they're each signatories. And that's what that means. The fourth director to make a quorum could be one from one of the signatories or from the federal government. But that is what's required for a quorum.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Are there any other questions? I have a motion. Going forward, you're going to go back to the particular attorney general that had questions in reference to these items.
Yes.
What is the procedure after you've done that? And hopefully you'll get it done by next week, because I want to move this toward the agenda on the 27th.
Yes. My plan is I will contact the attorney generals and reach out to them on the executive session language that they would like to add back in. And I really have no concerns about that. If they want to add that back in, we can. We'll agree language, and then I will send out a revised version and highlight the changes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one last request.
Please.
Have you talked to General Counsel, Department of Transportation?
No.
About the change?
The U.S. DOT? No, I have not. Would you like me to reach out to her?
Yes, please.
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay. There being no further questions, no further business to come before the committee, may I have a motion to adjourn, please? All right. Second?
Second.
Okay. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right. Those all in favor, hereby adjourn. Thank you. They have. You know, they have. They really.